Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee will come to order. There is a quorum, and I think we will move straight to... I thought we were moving straight to Chair Mulery's bill, but I see him walking away.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I thought I told you to move it down. They're looking at
great.
An agreeable amendment.
Excellent. Thank you, Chair Mulery. Representative Howes, welcome to the committee. I hope you can finish your important phone call to the President, and sorry to interrupt it.
Better than that, Mr. Chairman, it was my wife.
Oh, yes. Well, say hello to her next time you speak to her, please, from everyone here in the committee. Welcome to the committee, Representative Howes, and I believe that Representative Johnson is happy to move House File 270 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome to the committee, and present your bill, please.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, no bill is simple, but this is short. In statute dealing with juveniles, I believe everything dealing with a juvenile allows the court to oversee a juvenile until they're 19 years of age, except for a habitual truant. Now, even a runaway can be under court jurisdiction until they're 19. And some folks from my county brought this forward with the school and the Cass County Attorney's Office and the social workers, and they felt they work with so many kids that they get so close to finishing either their GED or their high school education that if they could keep them until they were 19, they would be even far more successful, and that's what this bill would do.
Thank you for the very straightforward presentation. I believe Representative Olin has a question.
No question, just a comment on this bill. As a former prosecutor of 32 years that handled juvenile cases, this is an excellent bill.
Bringing endorsement there, Representative Collins.
I will take it as such, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone in the audience who would like to testify on either for or against this bill? And any questions from the committee? Representative Holberg, would you be willing to move this bill to the consent calendar?
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
I'll move it to the consent.
Thank you. Thank you, Dennis. I think that Representative Johnson, would you willing to withdraw your motion to lay it over? And Representative Bigham moves House File 270 be recommended to pass and sent to the consent calendar. Any other discussion on the bill? Then on Representative Bigham's motion, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? The motion prevails. Congratulations, Representative Howes. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this is the shortest time I've spent in front of a committee. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Howes. Representative Gardner, I see your shining mug in the audience. Would you like to...
Yeah,
that's
right.
All right. Thank you. And Representative Bigham, might you be ready to proceed with House File 2205? Oh, excuse me. I see Representative Portman as well. We're playing a little juggling here, so... Representative Portman, thank you for your flexibility. Welcome to the committee, and if you could present House File 1756.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm pleased that you're able to move us up on the schedule. We have a room full of IBEW members across the hall in higher ed, so I'm anxious to get back. I'm bringing to you today House File 1756, which pertains to titles for motor vehicles. And what I would appreciate it would be if a member of the committee would be willing to move that the bill be passed and re-referred to the Committee on the Transportation Finance Division.
Representative Pimar moves that House File 1756 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee with a recommendation to go to the Transportation Finance Division.
It does not have to go back to Finance. It can go straight from here to Transportation Finance Division.
If you can hold on 1 second, Representative Portman.
It has the policy. To check with the highest authority, Sean Ron, send right back to Transportation Finance Division.
Thank you, Representative Portman. Representative Pimar, are you going to amend your motion to go directly to the Transportation Finance Division? Thank you. To your bill, Representative Portman.
This bill is brought to me by the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, Driver and Vehicle Services, and they are here to present the bill.
Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Larry Olala. I'm the Vehicle Services Program Director for the Driver and Vehicle Services Division of the Department of Public Safety. This bill, as Representative Hartman indicated, is a department initiative. What it does is it addresses basically two issues. The first issue deals with salvage vehicles. Currently, a vehicle that's damaged in Minnesota and purchased by an insurance company for payment of damages automatically becomes a salvage vehicle. The statute, however, is a little bit less clear when a vehicle is damaged and purchased for payment of damages by a foreign state insurer. And we have had situations where a vehicle is coming to the state of Minnesota, not necessarily received a salvage status from the foreign state, but has been damaged, has been purchased by the insurance company, and we have lost a challenge whereby the vehicle is not able to go through the salvage process and then be eventually branded as a prior salvage vehicle. And so what we're doing is trying to level the playing field between Minnesota vehicles and foreign state vehicles. The second primary portion of the bill deals with dealers reporting vehicles that are being junked, dismantled, and so on. Currently, there is a requirement that if a vehicle is being destroyed, dismantled, that be reported to the Department of Public Safety. However, in dealing with our other title processing and so on, it is not a high priority to get some of these junk vehicles on record. It ends up where these records kind of carry on. We do get the titles, we do get the reports, but we aren't necessarily able to update them electronically. What this provision of the bill would require is that dealers would report to us electronically that the vehicle has been junked, and then they would destroy the title. It updates the records, makes the records much more identifiable as junk vehicles and much more readily available to law enforcement and other individuals. So those are the two primary portions of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Ola. Any questions from the committee? Anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against this controversial bill? Seeing none, Representative Paymire renews his motion to pass House File 1756 and we refer it to the Transportation Finance Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Portman.
Thank you, members of the committee.
Representative Gardner, are we still waiting?
One more.
Great.
There you go.
And Representative Bigham, we're waiting.
Mr. Chair, I'm waiting for a witness too. I did tell him I was second to last on the agenda, so he is doing due diligence for the Hennepin County Attorney's Office.
And then I believe that the motion may be, do we have minutes in our packet? That's too bad. The committee will stand in recess until, let's say, 1 o'clock, and I believe everything should be in order from them. Thanks for your patience. And Representative Bigham, welcome to your committee. I believe that Representative Holberg will move House File 2205 to the consent calendar. Is that correct, Representative Holberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to make that motion.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And Representative Bigham, to your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a very simple bill. It's just some clarifying language regarding 609-108, putting in the provision that the sentences imposed to crimes committed before August 1st, 2005 were with the prior language. Anything after comes under the new language under 609.108. That's the bill.
Thank you, Representative Bigham. Do you have anyone to testify on behalf of you?
No.
Excellent. We like that. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either before or against the bill? Seeing no one, any questions from members?
Mr. Chair, I'd renew my motion that House File 2205 be recommended pass and referred to the consent calendar.
Representative Holbrook's motion is renewed. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? The motion prevails. Congratulations, Representative Bingham. Representative Gardner, welcome to the Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee. And I believe that Representative Simon will move House File 1895, be recommended to pass, and be referred to the Finance Committee. Welcome to the committee, Representative Gardner, and present your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Today I have a very simple bill today that was brought to me by an acquaintance I had through our state senator. And I also have a quick testifier from legal aid that can talk to the bill.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jane Bowman, and I'm a student at William Mitchell College of Law. And as Representative Gardner said, this is a very simple bill, and this would first and foremost help our indigent clients access justice. This bill simply clarifies what's already in practice, namely covering copy costs when an indigent client moves forward with their legal claims.
Thank you, Ms. Bowman. And anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against House File 1895? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Amber Hawkins. I'm with Legal Aid. We support this bill. As you know, our clients are indigent. Virtually all of them are. That's how they qualify for our services. We routinely secure informal papyrus, affidavits, and orders to help with court costs that are required. Most of the time, clerks will just make the copies. It's part of what everyone perceives as informal papyrus. Once in a while, they want you to go back to the judge and get a specific order, you know, including copies of the court file, but for the most part, it's routinely done. And this bill will just make sure that it's uniformly practiced throughout the state, no matter what court or clerk you happen to be dealing with. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hawkins. Anyone else wish to testify either for or against the bill? Then we'll proceed to questions from members. Are there any questions, any discussion from members? Seeing none, Representative Simon renews his motion that House File 1895 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, I was going to just let you know that my scrap metal bill is coming before the Finance, Public Safety Finance, and I've done a lot of homework, and including on data practices, and I think we'll have something all the stakeholders will work on. I just wanted to let you know.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. Perhaps you might want to sell tickets to the events or fund the scrap metal program.
Go find sellers.
So, are you ready to go on 93?
No.
If members could be patient for 1 second. Representative Holbrook.
Mr. Bearden's going to look for Representative Zeller. So.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Members, we do appreciate your patience as we're waiting for Representatives Dabney and Zellers to come to the committee and research to finish an amendment, I believe, to House File 93, or at least to. we'll give this a couple of minutes, and if we need to recess again for a few minutes, we will. But we're hoping to not need to. We're moving pretty quickly here.
Joke.
Representative Lesh, do you have any humor to bring to the table?
Do you have the bills before us? Yeah, we have.
Representative Cornish, any jokes today?
Sure. Guy walks into a bar with a great big chunk of asphalt underneath his arm, and he says, "Give me one for the road."
And Representative Cornish, in this very room, in about 3 hours, the Transportation Committee will actually have an answer to the porosity of the road and how many drinks they could handle. But
that's the way they structure prisoners.
Representative Zellers,
yes,
welcome to the Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee. We really appreciate you coming in to present your bill and your flexibility in making this happen on a timely fashion.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1542 for consideration by the committee.
Excellent. Thank you, Representative Holberg. Representative Zellers, House File 1542 is now before us, and please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and you've heard it before, and I can honestly say this really is a simple bill. If you look at page 2 on the bill, what we're doing, and I'll give you a brief explanation after I show you on lines 2.7, 2.8, we're changing the total weight, and the bill as it's coded talks about the methamphetamine precursor. Really, this is about Sudafed. I, along with several thousands, if not millions of Minnesotans, am an allergy sufferer. This is coming into the terrible season. I have a box here, and there's nothing in here, so I'm not bringing drugs into the committee, or a methamphetamine precursor.
Got that happen.
Yeah, Representative Lilly did that for us last evening, but I appreciate the restraint, Representative Sellers.
Okay, and the little red pills, the blister packs that you saw used a lot in the methamphetamine production, and we have, and I was a co-author of former Representative Johnson's bill. We've 80% of the production in our state's been cut. We did what we were looking to do. However, one of the accidental side effects was that allergy sufferers in the state of Minnesota are now being limited in the amount of medication they can buy. This is a 10-day supply. It's an over-the-counter, 24-hour medication. So you have to take it once a day, but then it stays in your system. Allergies as a whole, allergy medicines operate on, the more you keep in your system, the lower your symptoms will either be kept down or eliminated. Because of the way the methamphetamine law was written, on the 10th or 11th day, if I go to Target, Walmart, Walgreens, wherever, I can't purchase another 10-day supply. Sometimes it's the 13th day, sometimes it's the 14th day. And I can go, because there was a provision put in law, I can go to my doctor, get a prescription, go through the office visit, he'll check my symptoms, make sure, yes, you're an allergy sufferer, which basically adds to the cost of our healthcare costs, takes away from maybe somebody who actually does have a cold or actually does have something that they need immediate attention for, is taken away by my one trip into the doctor's office. Once I have a prescription, then I can get unlimited or up to a year, I believe it is. What we're trying to do here, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is just say that an allergy sufferer on the 10th or 11th day can go back in and get their 10th or 11th or another 10-day supply of their allergy medicine. There's no nefarious reasoning in here. There's nothing scary about how, and actually these, the Claritin tablets, I didn't bring them in, are the big white round ones. They're actually the most difficult to harvest methamphetamine out of. So it's not, we're not even actually adding to the amount of the little tiny red pills that are the easier. So this is, and I've actually brought in a copy. I talked to a number, I went and got my another 10-day supply this morning. I talked to the pharmacist and I said, how many complaints do you have about this on a regular basis? And the look of exasperation, which I've asked five or six other pharmacists, was, oh my God, you can't believe every day we have complaints about this. And they asked me why they're being felt like criminals for doing nothing more than coming in and buying their allergy medicine. And if you're over your limit, this is the receipt that you get. And I can pass these around if committee members would like to see them. That's literally all we're doing, Mr. Chairman, committee members. And I didn't bring in a pharmacist. I, had many of them who were saying yes, I was going to testify it. One retail outlet that will remain nameless but has a big red dot in the middle said that their complaints have actually gone up as high as the customer service desk for their customers being frustrated about coming in purchasing.
Yeah. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zellers, did you carry the meth bill last time?
Representative Zellers.
Mr. Speaker, Representative Hillstrom, I did not. It was Representative Johnson.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson is not here any longer, but do you know, are you suspecting that we will see an amendment to ban this substance again this year?
Representative Sanders.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, I do not believe we will. I think the two or three folks that offered that amendment last year, I don't think are here anymore.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my daughter was very sick this past year, and she was told by the nurse over the phone to go to get some Sudafed. And so in the middle of the night, 2-3 o'clock in the morning, I got up and drove to Cub to get Sudafed, and I was unable to get Sudafed. So I had to find a 24-hour pharmacy, which was a considerable distance from my home, to get her the Sudafed that she needed. At 2 in the morning, we weren't really up to going out in the middle of the night and getting a prescription because we would have had to do that at the emergency room.
Yep.
So I would encourage members to support this bill, provided we will not see amendments to ban the substance.
Representative Zellers?
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I promise you, Representative Hillstrom, I will, as one of those folks that goes in and has to go through this, the other problem that you see, and I didn't want to bring it up maybe necessarily, but you'll find a lot of folks have to have their spouse go and buy their allergy medicine for them. So, there's been a number of cases where folks have been caught doctor shopping for prescription drug painkillers. That's basically what you're forced to do then. If you go to, Cub or Target 1 week or one every 10-day period, then you have to go to Walgreens or some one of the other ones. Some of the folks, the retail, especially, I know Walmart and Target are actually linked, so when they scan your ID, they know if you've been at one of the other stores. So it's just encouraging a lot of, and besides a lot of frustration and angst with customers, it's making people who suffer from allergies do a lot of stupid things. But yes, I promise to represent Hillstrom. I will, anybody who offers to ban the substance, I will be the first one to jump down the throat.
Thank you, Representative Orman.
Mr. Chairman, where were we sending this bill, or what we're doing with it? Because it seems to me it's a consent calendar matter, and I'd make that motion.
Well, the motion before us is Representative Holberg's motion to lay the bill over for possible inclusion. Representative Holberg?
Well, Mr. Chair, where the bill's going, I think, is Chair Mullery's call. If it is deemed to be consent calendar material, then I would withdraw my motion and let somebody from the other side of the aisle make that motion.
Chair Mullery, will you put a microphone and advise the committee, please?
Mr. Chairman, whatever the committee wants to do with it, I agree with Representative Olin that it can go to the consent calendar.
Mr. Chair, I withdraw my motion.
Representative Holbert withdraws her motion. Representative Olin then moves House File 1542 be recommended to pass and sent to the consent calendar. Anyone who wishes to testify from the public on either on behalf or against this bill? No. Any more discussion from members? All those in favor of Representative Olin's motion to recommend House File 1542 to pass and send to the consent calendar, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you especially, Representative Olin. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Zellers.
Everybody gets a gun, or who gets a gun? Johnson going to get a gun?
I think he's playing with that.
He's a probation.
Pigeon's to Debo? He's in the room now.
Oh, I don't know. So you had them, I tell you.
They like it.
So we want to have a little Are you okay with the Dabney?
Representative Dabney, welcome to the committee. We really appreciate your flexibility and coming up in a timely manner. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate you sending out the folks with the shackles and the net and getting me and bringing me down to the committee.
Our next step is dispatching Representative Cornish, so you stayed below that that level of intervention. But
you know, I'm going to choose not to respond.
Okay, wise move, Representative Dabney. Representative Dabney, welcome to the committee. Representative Lesh moves House File 1171. Be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus data practices bill.
Very good.
Welcome to the committee and present your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I believe as I am speaking here, the pages are good enough to be delivering an amendment. This is largely a technical department bill recodifying their data practices statute. The bill was previously on your schedule, just for full disclosure here, ran into some concerns within the Department of Administration. I think it's fair to say that the Department of Labor and Industry heard those concerns. The amendment that you're receiving responds directly to those concerns, and I'm not aware of any issues, at least within the departments, within the governor's administration, over this issue at this time.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Lesh will move the A70442 amendments, to delete all amendments, so that the bill is in the shape that Representative Dabney would like it to be. All those in favor of Representative Lesh's motion? Representative Westman.
Mr. Chair, could Representative Lesh tell us what it's about? I don't have it electronically yet, and I don't even know if committee members have it.
Thank you, Representative Westman. We do have the paper version before us, and Mr. Baldwin may have some information for you that he's coming over to share with you, but perhaps Representative Dabney can just quickly, or the testifier can quickly walk us through. So to the testifier, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and if you could describe the 0442 amendment for the committee, we appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Rutusky. I'm the legislative director for the Department of Labor and Industry, and at the outset, I will tell you I have not personally been working on this bill. Our director of our legal services department was expected to be here, but she's not here, so bear with me. As Representative Dabney said, we introduced this bill at the beginning of the session. It was actually a bill we introduced last year as well. And the purpose of the bill was to respond to a Supreme Court decision from several years ago where the department had deemed some information on a work comp investigative case as public. The Supreme Court ruled that it was private. The commissioner has since had Freedom of Information Act requests for a variety of work comp data. Most of what the department does, by the way, is labor standards and work comp, prevailing wage, and now more recently with the governor's executive order, construction code and licensing. So the changes you're going to see here fall into those subject areas. As I said earlier, though, most of the litigation investigative work that the lawyers do at our department, litigation work, it falls in the area of work comp. And the rules that they make fall under the jurisdiction of the administrative law judge. And so while they have this Supreme Court decision in front of them from several years ago saying that this information is deemed private, there was conflicting rules under lower courts and by the administrative law judge saying, no, this piece of work comp data is public. So there was inconsistency over the years. The commissioner directed our legal staff last year to basically do an omnibus data practices bill to start cleaning everything up in all the various different functions of the department. As the bill came out, and it's my understanding the lawyers at the our department and the there's a small staff who, as you probably know, deal directly with data practices at the Department of Admin. After they had reviewed the bill, there was some disagreement on how our lawyers constructed the work comp privacy sections of the bill. They tried to work it. Have you been listening to my story? Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, I now have the director of the Legal Services Department for the department. I'll let her catch her breath, Nancy Lempink, and she will do a much, much better job than I will in explaining the bill. I was right at the point of explaining that we decided to pull out all the work comp provisions, and here is the delete all amendments.
Mr. Rakuski, you did a fine job of working on the fly. Ms. Lepic, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and if you could, just for your information, we're in the process of just finishing the description of the delete all amendments. Representative Western and others in the committee just want to make sure we fully understand it before we're before we proceed with adopting it. So if you can finish describing the amendment, and then we'll adopt the amendment, and then we'll continue the discussion.
Okay, I have, Mr. Chair, I have a summary. I wasn't able to put section numbers because I didn't have the amendment at the time, but I have a summary of the provisions that are included in this amendment, and I made copies for the committee. The department original game plan was to redraft the data practices laws such that it would more closely meet the needs of the department, would more closely work with how the department currently collects, creates, maintains, and disseminates data. That was our objective, because what we're finding is as we move to more electronic collection of data, storage of data, what the Data Practices Act is getting more and more out of step with the fact that we are no longer dealing with paper and manila folders. We're dealing with databases. So that was the primary motivation for the department to work on an overhaul of its various data practices provisions. Plus, many of our data practices provisions were out of sync with the Data Practices Act because they were enacted prior to the Data Practices Act. But we just couldn't reach agreement with the Department of Administration. We wanted a bill that would more work closely align with how we deal with our data. They wanted a bill that more closely aligned with the Data Practices Act, and we weren't able to reach agreement as to how to proceed. So what is now left in this delete all amendment has only a couple provisions that deal with our workers' compensation data, and the rest of the delete all amendment is primarily focused on actually our labor standards and apprenticeship unit. So if you both walk through the amendment, the first subdivision 2 is, let me see, it has to do with the first line 1.15. I think these are just all amendments initially to cross-references to the Data Practices Act. So consequently, the substance of the bill really begins on page 3.14, which begins with hours of operation. We deleted the lines 13.17 to 13.19, which is an amendment to section 175.10, because it's inconsistent with other provisions of law. The department no longer holds hearings, and consequently a reference to having hearings be public doesn't make any sense. And furthermore, not all of the department's proceedings are public. And so consequently, having all proceedings of the division shall be shown on its records, which are public, would also be inconsistent with other existing provisions of law. And have so we simply repealed those so that we no longer have that inconsistency. On lines 3.22 to 3.25, the Department of Labor and Industry is in a fairly unique role in because we are the official repository of the workers' compensation claim and an individual's workers' compensation claim. So that means that not only do we collect and maintain data and create data that's specific to the functions of the department, but we are also the official repository of the legal record of an individual's workers' compensation claim. So consequently, in that role, so we are not only for the employer, the insurer, and the employee, but also for the Office of Administrative Hearings and the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. They all access our image database for purposes of referring to official documents that are related to an employee's claim. Consequently, the department has a very high demand for copies of this record. In fact, we have several full-time staff and a whole unit of the agency who literally just makes copies of various parts of work comp claim record related, and primarily it's provided to attorneys and to insurers who want to get access to those records. So consequently, in light of some of the recent amendments to the copying charges in the Data Practices Act, the longstanding practice of the agency for charging for this service no longer jived with the language in the Data Practices Act, and so consequently, lines 3.22 to 3.25 are inserted to cover the cost of providing this service. All it does is cover the cost of the service. Lines 3.28 are just the definition section for the provisions that follow. And the provisions that follow begin on line 4.8 on page 4. So beginning with the letter B, in parens, the following data collected and maintained by the department are classified as private data on individuals or non-public. So that means that the subject of the data can get access to the data, but no one else, or if it's not an individual but a person, then the person may get access to the data that's about them, for which they're the subject. That's the definition of non-public data. So we begin then on line 4.10. The intent of 4.10 to 4.13 is to permit the department to protect the identity of individuals who file complaints with the agency. The chapters that are referenced are the work comp statute, the minimum wage, overtime, and prevailing wage statute. That are contained in chapter 177 and Chapter 181, which is the titled labor law, and there are certain provisions in Chapter 181, which is the very miscellaneous employment law section of the statutes. There are several sections in that law for which the department has enforcement authority. Consequently, we receive complaints regarding violations of those provisions, and we would be obligated to investigate. So that number one protects the identity of the individual who files the complaint. B2 protects the identity of individuals who respond to our request for information. Often in response to particularly a minimum wage and overtime complaint, the department will do what is called a survey, and it will request information from other employees who are employed by that same employer to get a sense of the scope, often, of the violation, whether it's unique to this particular complainant or whether it's an across-the-board employment practice of the employer. So we are frequently requesting information, often in the form of a survey, which then employees respond to. We would like to be able to keep the identity of those employees not private or protect or non-public. And also, actually, those are limited to individuals, so it would not be an entity other than a human being who would have provided us with that information. Now we move on to line 14.17. What this does is that some of the data that we collect as part of a work comp inspection investigation, because it's related to an employee's claim, for example, insurer inappropriately denies a claim, we would investigate that. We audit all denials of benefits by an insurer. If the denial is either inappropriate in any way, either because it's not sufficiently specific as required by rule to put the employee on notice as to the reasons why their claim was denied, or there's some other problem with that denial, we would investigate it. That, because it's related to an individual's work comp claim, it would be maintained in that individual's work comp file within the agency. What lines 4.17 to 4.20 does is it says, in addition to, in those instances, the identity of someone filing a complaint with the agency or information provided as a part of an investigation that's put in the employee's file would be accessible by the employee, the insurer, and the employer, who under current law have access to that data.
Ms. Leppert, we appreciate the incredibly thorough job you're doing of explaining the bill. If we could, we're actually making sure that the following bills are in the shape that they need to be in, but in about 3 minutes, maybe 2.5 minutes, you could explain the rest of the bill, the rest of the amendment, and we'll proceed with, I think there's a testifier, and then try to move
the next section
the
of the bill deals with, I'm sorry.
Ms. Leppert, thank you.
The next section deals with if there's a dispute between a sponsor of an apprentice and an apprentice, there is a process by which that apprenticeship agreement may be terminated. Sections 4.21 to 4.30 govern the department's investigation of that determination or request for termination and the data that's created as part of the appeal process that's provided for in statute 178.09 subdivision 1. Lines 4.31 deal with department's prevailing wage surveys. Department has been advised by people who don't respond to our prevailing wage surveys that one of the reasons they don't respond is because they're concerned about the confidentiality of the data that they do respond, or they do provide. So this section protects the that certain data that's provided in those surveys, the primary purpose of which is to encourage more people to respond to them so we have a better data sample from which to set prevailing wages. The next section deals with we collect as part of our investigations payroll data, particularly in the wage and hour area. This allows us to protect that payroll data that's provided to us by the employer, which the Department of Admin has previously advised us that is otherwise would be public. So often employers just give us anything and everything, however they happen to store the data. All we can, so we get like child support, withholdings, all kinds of other information that really isn't necessary to our investigation, but because that's how the employer stores it, they give it to us. What this would allow us to do is keep private some of that data that would otherwise, under current law, be public. Then the next set of data has to do with our logger program. The next set has to do with our ability to use, maintain, and disclose data for purposes of performing our responsibilities under the law. G has to do with logger training, which currently is private, but for purposes of DNR programs and private programs, it's necessary for the department to confirm that loggers have received training that's provided by the department. H allows us, we often have unclaimed pay wages because we lose employees in the process of getting their back pay, et cetera. This would allow us to give Social Security numbers to Department of Commerce, which is essential for putting them on dealing with this Unclaimed Property Act. They need a social security number in order for them to process this unclaimed property, so then people can go to their website and discover that they have unclaimed property. So this will hopefully allow us to find more people to get them their back wages. The final has to do with allowing us, when it's in the discretion of the agency, to further the law enforcement process, to promote public safety or health, or dispel widespread rumor or unrest, to allow the commissioner in his discretion to disclose data. A recent example of this is when we had the satellite dishes that people had in their houses that weren't properly grounded. We were in the process of the investigation. It became apparent that there were thousands of residences that had these dishes that were not properly grounded, created an electrical and fire hazard for these homeowners. The department used its discretion to release this information for public health and safety. What this does is make it clear that we can release any data in the department that would further those purposes in the commissioner's discretion. That's the bill.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lepik.
Yes, are there?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, members, just to overstate the obvious, this is a DE amendment.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Westrum.
Mr. Chair, Nancy, I forget your last name. I'm trying to rush through the summary that we get as well as the bill, and still haven't gotten the amendment, but maybe this applies to the discussion, but maybe the amendment changes some of these sections. There's a section in there that removes the misdemeanor charge for an employee that releases information. Is that still in the bill?
Ms. Lepik.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum. Yes, that is in the bill because it's the position of the department that there are a couple provisions in the Data Practices Act that provides for discipline of state employees for inappropriately releasing data, and those civil remedies are more important than appropriate than the criminal remedy that's in the department statute.
So that's not in the amendment.
What?
That's not being changed in the amendment. Still in the bill.
Ms. Lepik.
Yes, that's Representative Westrum. It is.
Okay, well, Representative Westrum. Mr. Chair, it will be a point of contention as soon as we get the amendment. Secondly, another part of the bill is opening up the processes, if I understood it correctly, of dispute resolution, mediation, arbitration. Is that a change that's in the amendment, or is the bill opening up those processes? Ms. Lepik.
The Representative Westrum, the department has removed from the bill all amendments related to workers' compensation data other than the ones that I described. So consequently, there is no language other than what exists currently in law that would deal with that type of data.
I think it's Section 6, if I recall the summary correctly. Yes, we can move on the amendment, Mr. Chair, with further questions on the bill once we have it.
Thank you, Representative Westrum. Representative Emmer.
I'll wait until we move on.
Thank you. Representative Holberg.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to make the point that I'm assuming this is going to be laid over for the data practices bill, and sometimes these things take a while to digest, and I don't know if it's been determined when that bill will be put together, but hopefully Representative Westrum will have an opportunity to get the delete all amendment electronically and have an opportunity to review it.
Good point, Representative Holbrook, and that is indeed Representative Rush's motion is to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Data Practices Bill, which I believe will be assembled later this week. We'll all have a chance to look that over with a fine-tooth comb. I'd like to renew Representative Lesh's motion to adopt the 0442 amendments. We can at least get the bill in the shape that the author wants it before taking further questions and testimony. All those in favor of Representative Lesh's motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Let's see. Representative Emmer. So the bill is amended.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Lepik, I think, I just wanted clarification that you're taking out the criminal penalty, and you've made the determination, the department's made the determination that the civil penalties that are already in place in Chapter 13 are all that will govern the situation.
Ms. Leppich.
Sorry, Representative, I can't speak.
Representative Emmer.
Call me what you like.
Careful. Ms. Leppich.
Representative Emmer, we are removing the criminal penalty provisions that are currently contained in the department statute, 175. And we are, because we believe that the remedies that are available, that the legislature has provided for in Chapter 13 are sufficient to respond to actions on the part of an employee to inappropriately releasing or not releasing data. Under
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Ms. Leppich and Representative Dabney, I would respectfully disagree, and I would think that if we have an employee that's releasing private data on individuals, that there's nothing wrong with having the criminal, I think it's a misdemeanor in this right now. I don't see anything, and I guess I look forward to hearing at some point what the logic is for eliminating the criminal penalty and just keeping the civil, because it seems to me it can't hurt to have both.
Yeah.
Ms. Leppich, or Representative Ms. Leppich.
It's on page 5. 5.29 is the previous language that was in the department statute. And so, I guess I'm sorry. Representative Dabney was speaking to me, and I think I missed
what. Representative Emmer, repeat your question, please.
Thank you, Representative Kalin. Ms. Leppich, all I was pointing out, I think there's nothing wrong with keeping the criminal penalty that's in 175 point, I think it's 2.6 or 2.7. Please keep in mind that the civil remedy in Chapter 13 would require the person that's been harmed to bring an action to recover those civil penalties, and I see they may not want to do that. I think the criminal penalty would be appropriate if someone within the department is releasing private data on individuals, but just a thought.
Mr. Chair.
Hold on a second, Representative Western, if you could, please. Ms. Leppich?
Okay, great. Representative Dabney just reminded me of one of the other reasons, and that's that this is an absolute prohibition, that's as the law is written for the misdemeanor. So that means even if it's permitted under law, the way the law is written, you could be guilty of a misdemeanor. The way that it written is, any employee of the Department of Labor and Industry who shall disclose the names of persons supplying information at the request of such department shall be guilty of a misdemeanor. So the way that the law is written is that even if the law would make that data public, which there is much data that's supplied to the department that is public data, that this would make release of it a misdemeanor, which of course has been problematic for the department for years, and now that's another reason why we would like to get rid of it, because it's a very broad penalty, even when the data would, I mean, it's in conflict with current law. Clearly the Data Practices Act says certain data is public and you are legally obligated to disclose it. What this says is that the names of who shall disclose names of persons supplying information at the request of the department shall be guilty of a misdemeanor. It doesn't matter. It could be me calling you up and asking you to provide me with information, and if I disclose that you provided me with the information, arguably I would be guilty of a misdemeanor under the way this law is written. So what now, if there's an inclination of the legislature to have there be a criminal penalty for disclosing data, I guess I would suggest that, one, it not be just limited to the Department of Labor and Industry, and further that it be in Chapter 13, where the rest of the penalties are for an employee of the state disclosing data, and not just limited to the Department of Labor and Industry, and having this very broad provision that really doesn't make, I would say that on a daily basis we're violating this provision, because obviously we're compelled under the Data Practices Act to provide public data, which often is supplied by people to the department. So this is an unworkable provision and has been for years. We were cleaning it up in the process of cleaning up the rest of the data practice language in our statute. So.
Thank you, Ms. Lepic. I believe there's another testifier to this point. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and present your case.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Lori Byer-Kopensky. I'm the Director of the Information Policy Analysis Division at the Department of Administration. And to Representative Emmer's question, the Data Practices Act also has misdemeanor penalties for willful violations. So any release of private data would also not only are civil remedies, but also subject you to misdemeanor penalties as well for any willful violation.
Thank you, Ms. Kopensky. Representative Westrum?
Mr. Chair, maybe just so staff has a little time, I think we should look at an amendment to strike that provision, so maybe staff could look at the appropriate oral amendment. I believe it would just be a strike, such and such a section. But to Ms. Lepic's conversation, it's a bit puzzling to me because you're saying the department would be, or a prosecutor would be compelled to bring a misdemeanor, or could bring a misdemeanor against somebody for releasing public data. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Well, when I read,
Ms. Lepic,
Chairman, Representative Westrum, when you read the language that's deleted, it says any employee of the department who shall disclose the names of any person supplying information at the request of such department shall be guilty of a misdemeanor. There isn't anything that says private data or not public data discloses not public data. It just says supplying information at the request of the department discloses the names of any person supplying information. And I would maintain that there is much data in the department that is supplied to us by persons that is public data. And we would be, under the Data Practices Act and our own statute, obligated to disclose it. Mm-hmm. But this provision would say if we do, we would be guilty of a misdemeanor.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Representative Weston, it seems to me that there's a much easier fix to this. And maybe Representative Lesh could inform us how many times he would prosecute somebody for releasing public data that's not protected under the Act under this misdemeanor. I think the intent of the law, and I, without looking at it further, I think you might even be misconstruing it, but perhaps not. If it's written wrong, we need to fix it. But just to say that your house cleaning effort then was to clean it up and just delete it seems like we go the wrong direction. Why don't we just insert a phrase that refers to the data we're trying to that's not public at the time that they release it. That's an easy fix. So it seems to me that there's more involved here that the department's trying to do than just clean up an old statute that's been clumsy. Representative Lesh, maybe you could answer how many times you would be prosecuting under this statute if you interpret it the same way as Ms. Lepic.
Representative Lesh. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Westrum, rarely do I ever prosecute similar types of violations brought to me by state agencies. In most cases, I'll use an example, a recent situation I had, where you had Department of Weights and Measures had issues with usage of the word premium on certain premium gas pumps. Usually, the agency goes back and forth with these violations many, many, many times. And the only time they will ever bring them for prosecution of a misdemeanor to my office is when, in their perception, the violator has been absolutely belligerent. And so I almost never see these. I don't know if that answers your question. But.
Representative Western.
So, Representative Left, what you're saying is, even with this on the books, is you'd have to first violate the intent of the law, and then even then would be rare that you would be prosecuted. Is that accurate?
That's
Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Western, that's my experience, yes.
So, Representative Western.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Lepic, maybe we could reconsider that position, that initiative. The second thing you talked about, the civil remedies are in place for the person. The concern I have with that is the criminal, there's a prosecutor who's paid by the taxpayers of the county to enforce the law that we have on the books. The civil side, somebody has to pay out of their pocket to even find relief or fairness or justice. And so I have concerns that we just go that route. And maybe you can tell me in the last 10 years how many people have specifically been in, brought a suit against an employee who's done it and recovered the damages, not against the data privacy violations, but the specific remedies that you're referring to against the employee. How many times have you punished or reprimanded or had an employee that's had a specific suit brought against them under those remedies in the last 5 or 10 years?
Ms. Levick, if you could hold on 1 second. I just want to note the time. It's 2:06. We've decided, just for members' information, we'll be moving House Files 93 and 2265 to this evening's agenda. We believe that there's still some information being worked on both of those bills. We do have another testifier, and we have at least one more committee member on the list, and I would like to get us out of here close to 2 o'clock. So just for information, and if you can then answer Representative Westrom's question, Ms. Levick.
Representative Westrom, just as a reminder that Ms. Byer-Krupensky has just indicated that there are also criminal penalty provisions in the Data Practices Act. So you wouldn't be limited just to civil remedies in the Data Practices Act. But to answer your question, I do not have a recollection of an employee of the Department of Labor and Industry being sued for releasing or not releasing data that was as required by law.
Representative Westrom, Ms. Lepic, that's the answer I thought it would be. And so, Representative Dabney, would you be willing to work on this misdemeanor language, and maybe we can clean it up so it does what it does, what we all think it would be intended to do, or could we lay it over? Could I work with you on that?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, I actually have a stab at it if you would like to hear that.
Perfect. I'd be willing to. I'd like to hear that.
I think Representative Simon would like to add his wisdom to the conversation before you wield that knife. Representative Simon.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just to that point, I'm not so sure that's accurate, though, about the Data Practices Act applying here, because if you look at line 1.5, 1.6, and 1.7, it explicitly says that the sections referred to, the foregoing sections, or the ones after that, I should say, are codified outside Chapter 13. So I'm not so sure that the Chapter 13 Data Practices Act provisions, criminal or civil, would apply here if I'm reading that correctly, or am I overreading it?
Representative Dabney, Representative Westrom, might I suggest that it sounds like we do need some more thorough consultation on this piece, and that that you engage in the discussion before we look at the Omnibus Data Practices Bill, and we can address it when it comes before the committee later this week. Are you comfortable with that, Representative Westrom?
I would, Mr. Chair. Just the staff that's here, if they could just note this and maybe set up a time that they could meet with me and we could look over some of the language.
I believe that Mr. Garing has already been looking at the issue a little bit, and we'll continue to do so with your help and with the office's help.
Representative Dabney.
Representative Dabney,
just for the committee's understanding, if I understand Ms. Engler correctly, apparently Representative Simon, Chapter 13 includes a provision that says, we gotcha. Even if you're codified outside of us, we still apply. And for the record, Ms. Engler is nodding that I understood her correctly. we can. The department has indicated a willingness to look at tweaking this language. I do think there's a legitimate question before the committee, however, of do we have redundant provisions in law so that we have a catch-all provision for everybody that we're really going to get you if you're the Department of Labor and Industry. I think that's a legitimate policy question for the committee.
Agreed, Representative Dabney, and do hope that you and Representative Westrom and Council can work out an agreeable solution before the end of the week on this issue. I believe we have another testifier to the bill. It is a couple of minutes before 2. We'll give you 2 minutes, and then we are laying this bill over, of course, for possible inclusion data practices. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Meister. State your name for the record, and if you can keep it to 2 minutes, we really do appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. If you take a look at the Department of Labor and Industry website, you will see that it does a fair amount of investigations of data. OSHA, living wages, those kinds of things. What this bill does is basically, they're not recodifying. They're rewriting the law to serve their department's service, their department's interest, and not serving the interests of the public. That's my main concern. And one of the things that this bill does is make a lot of things, in my judgment, secret that the public will never know. You heard about publicly about how there was differences between the Department of Administration and the Department of Labor on this bill. Secondly, there was a Western decision that was done by the Supreme Court and shook at the hands of the Department of Labor and Industry for doing things that they shouldn't do. Then, on the Department of Administration opinion that came out just two months ago in January, basically said by the person that's now representing the department, we're going to be doing things differently because we want to be sure we're overreacting. We're sort of like we're going to close down some things that may be public, and so we don't get our hands caught in a cookie jar making wrong decisions. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, these are some of the following questions you need to ask. What was public beforehand? What is now going to be private? What was now public and what is now going to be non-public under this bill? I'll give you one example. One of the basic premises of the Data Practices Act, if there's an investigation going on of a company or someone that is non-public, you could find out what company is being investigated or after the fact, after it becomes inactive and the investigation is complete. I contend that the language that is here now, you'll never know the name of the company. You'll never know how many complaints have been against them. You'll never know in a summary kind of fashion, even those kinds of things, specific things.
30 seconds, Mr. Newman.
So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is not a recodification. It's a rewrite. It's where the department believes that in their best interest, how they can share the information and not wanting to go with some of the standards and some of the practices that are held by every state agency and other local political subdivisions within the state of Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the few moments of your time.
You're most welcome. Representative Dabney, any last words before we lay this bill over for possible inclusion?
Mr. Chair, members, I look forward to continuing to work on this bill and hope for its inclusion in the Omnibus Data Practices Bill this year.
Thank you for coming before the committee, and thank you, members. The Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee will stand in recess until 6 p.m., where we will meet in room 500 North this evening. See you then. The Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee will reconvene and come to order again. First up tonight is House File 1505, Representative Cornish. Thanks for bringing treats for everybody.
Yeah. You have a visiting committee.
Oh, that's right. And Representative Cornish, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, and I don't know what destination you're going to hold it over for possible inclusion, Mr. Chair.
I do believe that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, I would move the bill for possible inclusion.
So moved. And present your bill, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, this is everybody says it, but it's a fairly simple bill, as you'll see if you read through it. House File 1505, what it does is modify Statute 299A641 regarding membership of the Gang Drug Oversight Council. And the 299A641 created the Minnesota Gang and Drug Oversight Council. And during the hearing in the Senate, I guess this was originally the Senate, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it was thought there by the Senate Council that they would like to, when they were doing an overview of the Gang and Drug Oversight Council, that they didn't have anybody on this council, as they do a lot of the councils, like CRIMNET Advisory Board and Center for Rural Policy Development, some of the others, they have people appointed from the legislature. And so this would add non-paid members, Senator to serve on the committee having jurisdiction over criminal justice policy chosen by the subcommittee on committees and the Senate Committee on Rules and Administration, and then a representative serves on the committee having jurisdiction over criminal justice policy chosen by the Speaker of the House of Representatives. And the legislative members of the council may not vote on matters before the council. What they would do, they could be in an advisory role and kind of like a oversight, and they would bring information back and report to their respective committees of jurisdiction back in the House and the Senate. I believe, Mr. Chair and members, that it doesn't have a fiscal impact because they plan on paying these through the normal reimbursement procedure for the that they use currently when you fill out that little blue form and turn it into your respective house. So that would be it. And the advisory role, non-paid, non-voting, and no cost to the state, but the better coordination for the Gang Drug Oversight Council.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Any questions from members? Just a quick question from me, Representative Cornish. Just curious, why leaving it as just a lay member of the lay senator on the committee and lay representative on the committee rather than chair? Did you give that any thought?
No. I know when I was a member of CRIMNET, they assigned one, I think it was chair from the Senate and me from the House. And the guidelines, the others, I don't think specify. They just say a member usually. That way they can pick either a chair or a lay member.
Great. Thank you, Representative Cornish. Seeing no, is there anyone in the public who'd like to, in the audience who'd like to testify either for or against Representative Cornish's complex bill? Seeing none and hearing no further discussion from the members, House File 1505 is laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Cornish. Representative Posh, welcome to the committee, and we have some work to do on your bill, but Representative Olin moves House File 1625 be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. And Representative Posh, first of all, welcome to the committee. Second of all, I believe you have an amendment, the DE1 amendment, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The DE1 amendment is an amendment that myself and the Chair, Chair Mullery, have worked on together to try to get it into a working form that the committee, I think, would be receptive to. So.
Excellent. I think Representative Olin seems to be gleeful in moving the DE1 amendment. Just to get the bill in the form that the author would like to have it. So all those in favor of adopting the DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Posh, two-year bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. It's very good to be here. This has been a work in progress for the last year and a half that has resulted from a constituent issue in which she is with me today to tell her story. But the bill before you today would allow that a restraining order or order for protection could be served to the respondent at their last known address, at the address of their employer, at an address of their family member or sibling, due to complications of being able to serve some individuals that have had previous orders against them, and essentially making the abuser or that person who has been stalked the person responsible to track down their own stalker, has really created some complications. And this tries to create a process and ultimate means to serve an order for protection or a restraining order and make sure that the needed protections are offered. I don't want to go too long into my own editorial comments, but with me today is Jennifer Walker from the St. Cloud area that I would love to have testify in front of the committee, and I think she would also be available for questions.
Thank you. Ms. Walker, welcome to the committee, and if you could identify yourself for the record and then state your testimony.
My name is Jennifer Walker.
and thank you for having me here. I'm very excited about this as well. Before I share my story with you, I feel it's necessary to make clear that my story is not one of paternity issues or solely domestic abuse. My story is one of years of stalking, harassment, and intimidation made possible by loopholes in the current law. The other adult in this process was instructed by our court several times to establish paternity and comply with no contact orders. He did not, and he was able to evade warrants and charges for years and manipulate the laws to his advantage. My story began about 11 years ago in a little house just a few short blocks up the hill from where we're sitting right now. I was 22 years old, I had a decent job, and I thought I knew pretty much everything. I met a man named Jason, and a young romance began. The romance soured quickly when I found out I was pregnant shortly thereafter. In the course of the next month, I found myself in a life of fear. I can still remember the smell and feel of the apartment. On the first night, he punched me in the stomach, screaming that he would kill my baby. I remember yet another night when I was pinned down, face down, on the floor, being kicked and hit, picked up, and thrown across the room into walls. Without the intervention of the neighbors and the police, I would not have made it through that one. I remember him grabbing the steering wheel of my car as he attempted to steer us off the ramp. I remember a smashed television, phones broken when I attempted to call police. There were daily phone calls that warned me not to go anywhere alone because I might not return. At night, I would sit awake with a steak knife in my phone by my side, watching out my window until dawn when I could leave for work in the safety of the daylight. The evening that I received a call from him letting me know that he had entered my second floor residence through a window and was waiting for me, that was the last straw. After I convinced the police he did not live there, they removed him and I was able to pack my belongings in the span of 4 hours and leave my home. I left mutual friends, my job, my apartment, without a forwarding address. A day later, my parents began receiving harassing late-night phone calls from Jason and his family with threats of their house being blown up and my younger brothers and extended family being harmed. I obtained the first of four court-ordered no-contact orders that week. Four. I began getting phone calls warning that he planned to come to my home. He was going to cut open my pregnant stomach so I could watch him murder my child, and then he would slash my throat. Over the next few years, after I moved twice, I experienced many other incidents, such as all the deadbolts in my house being unscrewed completely, extra house keys missing unexplainably, unexplainable flat tires on my car, appearances of cassette tapes in my player set to his favorite song, outside doors of my house found wide open in the morning when I knew I'd locked them the night before. I would get phone calls warning me not to leave my daughter alone or in daycare because she would be taken, and there were threats that if I was ever to marry, my husband and I would be killed. At last count, over 65 terrifying events have happened. My local police department filed a violation that stated numerous violations. However, they were condensed into and led to one single violation of the OFP against him. However, by this time, no one could find him because he had no listed address, no mortgage, no utilities in his name, no person, no traceable way to contact him. I was told by people that people like that who continuously break laws intentionally live untraceable lives. For several years, I lived in a spiral of fear and sleepless nights. People didn't contact me. These contacts resulted in my life changing from relatively normal college students to an urgent schedule of court hearings, sheriff visits, pleading for police in several counties to just cooperate with each other. This was no longer a domestic abuse. I was being stalked, intimidated, and harassed. When I called the police for assistance, I heard the same story over and over again. The police were sympathetic for my situation, but I was not being physically hurt, and they were limited by the current law. You see, although Jason had been charged with a violation of an order for protection, law enforcement would arrest him, and the courts would let him go, trusting that he would come back for the next hearing. When he didn't return, the courts would issue another arrest warrant, and the cycle would continue over and over and over. 5.5 years later, this one violation that initially was 65 was finally resolved. 5.5 years. but Jason decided to find me again and again. On the last occasion, I applied for a new order for protection and was actually granted a harassment restraining order because there has been no physical abuse. Because of the time lapse, being almost 10 years later, and the limited information that I had on his relatives and friends, I was unable to assist law enforcement in finding him to serve the order. I explained to everyone I talked to, I spent years trying to stay away from this person. The consistent message I heard was, it's up to the plaintiff to provide the current address for service. Specifically what I was told, unless you can give us the current address, we're unable to serve this order. It will be sent back to the originating county of Stern and be inactivated. During this period of time, I was told that he had been detained in Ramsey County for traffic violation and providing false information during the time that they were looking to serve him from a harassment order. However, since it was only a harassment order and not an order for protection, it was not listed on the statewide system of notification service, so he was released without being served on. I was also told by the Sheriff's Department that they had a recent address for Jason, but were unable to transfer the address that was listed on the screen in front of them into the harassment order that was sitting on the table in front of them, that incidentally later that day was about to be served to a 9-year-old address by the sheriff, because they were not allowed to do research on this. In order to find him and stop this stalking, I spent days on the phone with the women's shelters, the civil process departments, harassment offices, the county attorney offices, criminal divisions, civil divisions, the warrant divisions, the sheriff's department, in every county I knew he had lived in or been in the past 10 years, hoping to get a shred of information to help end this. As you can see, ultimately, I had to resort to stalking my stalker. Rather ironic, isn't it? Not only did I make these calls, I drove through the neighborhood and previous employment site that he used to be at in the hopes that I could give the police information on where to serve him. The end result was unsuccessful. I did not find him, and the order was closed. If he finds me, we'll just start this all over again. Over the past 11 years, I've spent thousands of dollars in moving expenses, security systems, personal security devices. I've moved repeatedly, sometimes in the middle of the night. I've lost sleep guarding my daughter. I've shared our story with more officials than I can count. I've changed my name. I've unlisted my phone numbers. Lost contact with former friends. Left jobs. I've had to be valiant about keeping our location confidential. I live in the spiral of what ifs whenever Jason decides to find me. I've been forced to raise my daughter to understand that all doors must be deadbolted and windows locked at all times. She has grown up knowing that the fenced-in backyard is her only play area. All of this because of one individual who has demonstrated the ability to evade laws and find loopholes in every charge and warrant he has had, which has been many. Based on previous violent behavior, I believe Jason is capable of harming me again. I don't know what event will trigger his next attack or when he will find us. And I always wonder, what if he finally makes good on those threats? As you may remember, this story began almost 11 years ago in a little house just up the hill from where we sit right now. Unfortunately, my story is not unique. Chances are there's a young woman living up on that same hill right now just starting her story. For her, I ask that at a very minimum, you consider harassment restraining orders be posted on the same alert system and given the same priority as orders for protection. That would have solved a lot of trouble for me. Survivors of abuse and stalking should not have to be responsible for finding the abuser or stalker, for the law enforcement to serve a harassment or protection order. But the duration of harassment and protection orders will not be limited to 2 years, but will be based on previous orders, violations of previous orders, and the defendant's criminal history with respect to violence. And finally, that all these violations finally be taken seriously and not condensed for the purpose of saving time or courtroom space. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Walker. Compelling testimony and
and say without passing judgment on the bill that, you have the sympathy of our of this committee for your ordeal. Thank you for bringing your story forward. Representative Smith?
Chairman, thank you. Representative Hosh, your bill proposes a permanent restraining order. And does the penalty for the, should the court impose a sanction for violation of the permanent order, how does that differ if at all from the duration or the type of sanction on a temporary restraining order?
Representative Hosh.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, you're referring to the original bill before the delete everything amendment.
Okay.
I would love to continue to talk about my original version of the bill. I can pursue that in the future.
And I'm only referring, excuse me, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, looking at what's in my amendment.
Representative Smith, I actually have a spare copy of the amendment.
Yeah. And the delete everything amendment, what it would allow is service of a restraining order or an order for protection at the last known address, at an address of employment, and an address of a family member or sibling. It would give the alternate means, which is still up to the judge to determine that alternate service needs to be done. This would solve the situation in which Ms. Walker has described today. In all honesty, I would like to consider the possibility of a permanent restraining order in the future, as my original bill has, but at this moment I would like to take care of this explicit situation and move forward.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hosh, who's the Senate author of the counterpart?
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith. The Senate author is Representative Clark. Senator Clark, I'm sorry. And that should be introduced this week.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, that answers my question. It was going to be what's the status of the bill in the Senate, so it hasn't yet been introduced.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith. Due to some concerns with the original language and some input from individuals from legal services, she did not want to introduce the legislation until the delete everything amendment was drafted. And with this amendment, we are then moving forward on the Senate side.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hosh. Will the bill, will the bill is introduced in the Senate, can be the bill that you've introduced, or will it be the bill as amended?
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith. It is my full intention to have the delete everything amendment on the Senate side. I do not want to jeopardize the ability to move this legislation forward. So, yes, I intend to encourage, and I also know that the Senate author would do the DE amendment that we just incorporated today.
That's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to add additional testimony on this bill, either for or against? Okay, seeing none. Any other questions from members? Representative Cornish.
You may have already covered it, but it's so hard to hear over here. What's his status right now?
I don't know. I try to stay away.
What?
I don't know. I haven't known for many years. That's the point of why I can't find him. This relationship lasted 4 months.
He's arrested.
And he has been arrested since then. The Sheriff's Department did let me know that. However, I don't have access to confidential information, so I'm not sure where he's at right now. But this was a 4-month relationship that 11 years later, I don't want to know where he is. I want to be left alone.
Any other questions from members? If not, Ms. Walker, thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Hosh, have something to add?
I do, just because I'm happy to be here. I'm glad the committee's given me their time, and I believe very strongly in this bill. I want to reiterate that this is a situation in which a person has had to become a stalker of their own stalker. This is a situation in which a person has violated 3 previous order for protections dozens of times. This is a situation in which an individual who lives underneath the law without an address, who is mobile and pretty much unfindable, is being able to slip underneath the very systems that we've tried to implement to protect people. Please consider this bill strongly. I'll be talking to the members of this committee, but I think this is a good step forward. It's not an automatic alternate service, of previous orders have to have already been done on the individual, and I greatly appreciate your time.
Thank you, Representative Hosh and Ms. Walker. We will be laying over House File 1625 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus committee bill, and you have at least one advocate sitting here in this chair for its inclusion ultimately. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, it started out.
Representative Olin seems to be out in the hall gathering his wits for his sharp presentation of House File 506. Representative Olin, welcome back to your committee. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The staff is wondering if you just boogied up to the chair. I'm not sure if that's true, but would you like to move your bill, Representative Olin?
I'll move my bill number 506 for possible inclusion.
No, wait a minute. I do believe that's the motion you want to make. So you want to finish that motion?
Yeah,
that's possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, Representative Owen.
I had to go to finance, but there's not enough money, I believe.
Representative Owen, I believe that you may also have an oral amendment you'd like to make.
I have an oral amendment that was brought to my attention prior to this meeting, and I'd like everybody to listen so we understand the oral amendment.
If you could just hold on 1 second, Representative Owen, make sure that staff is ready to catch up and keep up.
Patrick has a copy of the oral amendment. I scribbled him a copy out. No.
Let's just hold on 1 second, Representative Olin. Proceed, Representative Olin, with your oral amendment, please.
Okay. On line 2.6, delete the colon, and then run 2.7 and 2.8 directly after subdivision. In other words, it's just one long sentence with in 10 years of a first, etc. Just move it up so it's just in one sentence. And then put a period at the end of adjudication of delinquency, period. And I notice, I realize, Representative Westrom, I apologize, because you are at a disadvantage here, because On 2.9, and this is the important part of this amendment, delete parenthesis 2, while possessing a dangerous weapon, comma, as defined in section 609.02, comma, subdivision 6, period. Delete that sentence.
Is that the end of your oral amendment?
That's the end of my oral amendment. Essentially what I'm doing is deleting the dangerous weapon wording.
Ms. Pirius, do you have that amendment?
Yes.
So we are deleting the main substance is we are deleting all of line 2.9 and the number 6 period from 2.10 and then fixing grammar along the way. Is that the amendment?
Right. That upon a felony, etc., becomes the next paragraph, basically.
Chair, I think... Representative Primar.
I think you'll delete the word or line.
That is correct. I need to get rid of the word or in the semicolon.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Primar, for your sharp eye. Great. And Representative Simon to the proposed amendment?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, and I don't know. If there's a 1, does there have to be a 2? Since we've gotten rid of the 2.
Right, that's right, I forgot.
I don't know.
It was my intent to get rid of the 1 when I said to move it up in a long sentence. I just forgot to say that. Thank you, Representative Simon.
So I believe, and committee, please check me and staff, and Representative Rowland, we are deleting whatever fluctuations at the end of line 2.6, deleting in line 2.7 the 1 in parentheses. On line 2.8, we're replacing the semicolon with a period, deleting or, deleting all of line 2.9, and deleting the 6 period on the number 6 and the period on line 2.10. Does everyone have the amendment?
Yep.
Excellent. To put the bill in the order the author would like it, all those in favor of Representative Olin's amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The bill should be in the shape that you would like it, Representative Olin, so to your bill.
At this stage, I'll turn it over to Assistant Attorney General David Boyd, and he can explain it. Thank you.
Mr. Boyd, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, if you could, and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is David Boyd. I'm a Deputy Attorney General. This bill is about closing a hole in the Domestic Abuse Act that allows repeat offenders of the no-contact order provision to be treated less seriously than repeat violators of a domestic abuse order for protection. The Domestic Abuse Act essentially provides the abused victim with two separate court orders to provide protection from the abusers. The first is the Domestic Abuse Order for Protection under Subdivision 14. And to get an order like that, the abuse victim needs to make an application to the court, possibly have a hearing if the application is contested, and serve the copy of the order upon the abuser before the order offers the protection that it offers. The other court order included in the Domestic Abuse Act is a no-contact order. And where the no-contact order comes in under Subdivision 22 is when the abuser is already charged with an offense, such as domestic abuse, harassment, or stalking. And when making an appearance, the judge has the authority to impose the no-contact order, thus sparing the victim the process of making the application to the court, going to the court hearing, and having to get that served on the abuser. Right now, a violation of a no-contact order is a misdemeanor, just like a violation of an order for protection. A second violation is a gross misdemeanor, but when it comes to a third violation within 10 years, there is no felony provision for the violation of the order for protection. There are no sentencing provisions for jail time or for other counseling. And essentially what this legislation does is closes that loophole to provide for the same penalties for repeat violations. It also, in Subdivision 16, adds attempts to violate the list of qualified domestic violence related offenses, and also adds first and second degree murder to those violations. Domestic violence is an important priority for Attorney General Lori Swanson, and this is a loophole or a gap in the statute that really does a disservice to victims of domestic abuse. When the abuser has been charged with an offense and then released from jail on bail, that's often the most vulnerable time for the abuse victim, and there's no reason to deny the abuse victim the protections of the law in that scenario, and also no reason to require the abuse victim to go through the process in order to get an order for protection. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Voigt. Any questions for Mr. Voigt? Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I signed on as a co-author and I didn't read the bill. I just wanted to... there's two things. One is there wasn't a fiscal note requested, and I'm not sure if we shouldn't try to do that quickly in case there is a bed impact with the felony. I don't know what kind of numbers we're talking about.
This is the bill of the minister.
But secondly, I would like to see some language, Representative Olin, and maybe we can do this between now and Friday as an amendment, when it says here that upon a gross misdemeanor conviction, blah, blah, the defendant must be sentenced to a minimum of 10 days imprisonment and must be ordered to participate in counseling. We don't specify what kind of counseling, and in statute we have very clearly spelled out the kinds of counseling that is most appropriate for domestic violence offenders. This to me leaves way too much latitude
before the court when this is very specialized treatment, especially someone who's violating a no contact order on the third go around. So this person has some serious problems, behavioral problems and attitudinal problems, and just simply going to counseling, I don't think does it. So I think it would be a fairly easy fix
The
statute, and I'd be happy to help put that together. But I would like you to address the fiscal component.
Representative Olin, first I'm hearing a willingness to work with Representative Paymar on the counseling definition before.
Yeah, I think we need some anger management or some other wording in there exactly, and I'm not sure exactly what wording I'd want to put, but
she's got it.
She got it. Experience, I believe, has a suggestion. So we'll hold on one quick second. Representative Western, if you could hold on one second, staff. Gotcha. Thank you. Appreciate your patience.
Thanks. Great. All night,
buddy. I'm hoping not.
So are the rest.
Even I, Representative Coles, even I know that that there is no roll call vote available on a layover. So.
All right.
Representative Olin.
I would move at this time to put after by the court period, instead of period, put as provided in section 518 capital B .02, which specifically is the OFP statute, which would be the, thus making it the same counseling the OFP statute would have in first place.
Representative Olin is, I believe, making a motion to amend House File 506 on line 2.2, after by the courts, inserting the words as provided in section 581B.02, 518, excuse me. Staff informs me that my dyslexia is actually kicking in at 7 o'clock at night.
If this makes sense.
And Representative Olin, is that your amendment?
Yes.
Great. Any questions from members about the amendment? All those in favor of Representative Olin's motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? The motion prevails. I believe that the second question was the first one that Representative Pingler had about the fiscal implications. Representative Olin.
And Mr. Baldwin can correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't this the one that Judge Gomez gave me the statement that said there was minimal effect? Isn't this the statute? I gave you a copy and I gave myself one. I gave Sheldon one, Johnson, I believe. And I don't even know where mine is. But I distinctly remember... But we're going to find it now.
Representative Paymar? Is that... would you like to work with Representative Olin, or do you have some concerns about where this bill may need to go?
We could just ask Mr. Carter, maybe, just to take a look at it. I don't know what the fiscal impact was.
Hold on, if you could hold on one second, members. Representative Olin, perhaps given Representative Paymar's question, you might be interested in withdrawing your original motion to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in this committee's bill, and we can recommend to pass the bill as amended and refer it to finance, to public safety finance.
And that's why I asked the question originally, because I wasn't sure if it didn't need to go to...
So would you like to withdraw your original motion?
Yes.
And then make the motion to recommend to pass and refer to public safety finance.
I believe Representative Western had a question.
Correct. I just want to make sure we have
the final motion.
Representative Olin, that is the motion that you'd like us to proceed with ultimately.
Great.
Thank you. Representative Western, thank you for your patience.
No problem, Mr. Chair. Representative Olin, this whole restraining order discussion, and it does seem to me that if we're making it a felony, it's probably going to lengthen some jail time or have some other fiscal impacts. But what do you think of this statement? And maybe this isn't the bill to amend or add it to, but
few years ago, I was working with some judges in my district, and the topic of restraining orders or no contact orders came up, and one of their suggestions to me was that we also write into law that when a restraining order is put in place, it's also a restraining order on the party that is asking for it. And they tell me they repeatedly see a scenario where somebody's requested a restraining order, a month goes by, a couple weeks go by, a couple months go by. For various reasons, they call up the person that's got the restraining order and not supposed to be in contact with them, and sometimes it happens in the middle of the night, and all of a sudden they're talking, and then they're, oh, I'm not going to press any charges. Next thing you know, they're back in court because somebody's violated the restraining order. Seems to me it should go both ways as I thought about it. What do you think of that? And maybe this isn't the right build attitude, but the fact that we're discussing it, maybe it is a policy we ought to change to try to negate that unintended or obvious outcome of a restraining order, that the idea is that both parties should be restrained from talking to each other or contacting each other. What's your thoughts?
Representative Olin, if you could first address the sort of structural question that Representative Western is asking, whether this bill is the appropriate vehicle for that conversation, and then that it should help determine whether your answer is expansive or concise.
Well, I'll keep the answer short under any circumstance. First, Representative Westrum, I don't think this is the right bill. And second, I do want to answer the other question, although, because I'm fully aware, and I have had situations in my 32 years prosecuting that I've heard that complaint, and I probably had reason to believe that that was happening. I don't think this bill is an appropriate place, though. But
Maybe we could work on it in a different bill, Representative Olin, or maybe it's not a real issue.
Representative Olin, any further comment?
I'm not convinced it's not a real issue, but I'm not quite sure I would be the one that would want to work on that bill.
Thank you, Representative Olin, and thank you, Representative Western. It is a good question. Any other comments or questions from members? Anyone in the audience who'd like to testify on either in support of the bill or in opposition? Then Representative Olin renews his motion that House File 506, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Public Safety Finance Division. To the Finance Division with further recommendation to be re-referred to Public Safety Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Olin. Representative Kranz, you will be revisiting your bill, House File 1273. Representative Kranz, thank you for moving to the testifier's table, and the House File 1273, the subcommittee report has been adopted, and I believe that you'll be moving to pass House File 1273 and refer it to the Finance Committee. Is that correct?
You read my mind, Mr. Chair.
As always, Representative Kranz, good evening, and please present your bill.
Thank you. I think we'll try to take maybe a lesser approach to the beginning and see if you want us to expand. But basically, this bill has already been heard in the Public Safety Subcommittee, where it passed on unanimous vote to come back here. But there is a fiscal part of it in the fourth part of the bill, which increases the offenses for repeat offenders of sex crimes. And therefore, it does have minor fiscal implications, and so therefore, that's the path we're seeking to Public Safety Finance. Now, I know a majority of the committee has already heard it. If you want to take the time, we can go through it again. Otherwise, I'm going to make that motion now unless any of the members have a request to hear more about it.
Unless it's the will of the committee, I think we will keep testimony brief.
Yeah, I mean, we do have broad bipartisan support on this. I have both minority and majority leader on the front page of it. It's a good bill. But
from what I gather, that's a wise move, Representative Kranz, obviously. Any questions from members or Representative Kranz? Seeing none, Representative Kranz renews his motion that House File 1273 be passed and re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Chairman members. Representative Simon, similar song and dance, I believe. Yeah. Representative Simon, I believe the subcommittee report on House File 1841 has also been adopted. Is that correct?
Correct.
Great. Thank you very much. And I believe that the motion is to lay the bill over for possible inclusion. Is that correct?
True.
Excellent. Representative Simon, would you like to briefly describe your bill?
Yes, briefly.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair and members. And I don't think there's a need unless the members want it for added testimony, although we're happy to provide any testifiers here. This passed without any dissent or really discussion, I think, out of the subcommittee. And basically what this bill does is it makes sure that those who are the victims of domestic abuse, as proved by a court, those who have a piece of paper from a court, an order for protection or a no-contact order, can get out of their residential lease early. Now, they still have to pay back rent, and they still have to pay 1 month's extra rent as a condition of their leaving, and they have to give a date certain to the landlord, so the property owner, by which they're going to be out of there. But there's a real need for this, and we have a testifier here who really bravely came before the subcommittee and told her story. And what often happens, as you can imagine, is that an abuser obviously knows where the person lives, and then becomes critical, often, for the abuser, either before or after, but certainly after having received either a no-contact order or order for protection, to move, to get out right away. And if she happens to be in month three of a 12-month lease, that can be a problem. So this just provides a way for her to get some relief, but also make sure that the landlords, you know, are compensated in some way for the inconvenience. And I do want to make a special mention here of the thanks that I have for Mr. Horner, representing the multi-housing folks. You know, he's been very cooperative. We've worked together on this. He's been very accommodating. Both sides gave a little here, but I think we're very close. This isn't the absolute final bill. I think in the next couple days we're going to tweak it a little bit more, but we're very, very close. I think he's nodding yes. We're very, very close. And actually, Mr. Horner testified on the record in front of the subcommittee that he supports the bill, even though it's not fully baked yet. It almost is. And he supports it. I can represent that. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Simon. And thank you also to Mr. Horner and Ms. Hudson from Legal Aid. We work on the bill. Any questions from members? Representative Westrum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simons, you said it's 1 month of they'd have to pay upon giving their vacation notice. Any other administrative costs for the landlord having to put an ad in the paper, re-rent the property, show it? There's administrative costs. I know some of the advocates that I talked to about this bill, when I raised the issue, seemed receptive to maybe having some sort of administrative costs that could be recovered because of shortened lease. Anything like that in there?
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Westrum. I think my read of the language is that lines 2.5 and 2.6 a sort of a catch-all provision that might cover matters or expenses that are otherwise in the lease. For example, if something in the lease says that upon termination there's a XYZ fee or whatever it's called, that would still be due and owing. I mean, because the language says unpaid rent or other sums owed to the landlord. And by the way, I neglected to mention the damage deposit. Of course, any damage deposit situation would have to be settled up as well. So that would remain unchanged.
Representative Western?
So, Representative Simons, Mr. Chair, thank you. If a landlord had a $250 fee for early termination or anything like that, it'd have to be in the lease. It wouldn't be something once they get that notice on March 1st, if they're leaving March 31st, could the landlord then impose an administrative fee for having to rent out the property sooner? I don't think it's the way that language is. I don't think it would be so that they'd be able to charge an administrative fee if they couldn't get the property rented out right away or free. I mean, sometimes they're standing at your door and you got a waiting list, and then it's pretty easy to just call the next person and say, hey, there's a vacancy, but you have to run an ad in the paper and have people run over to the property and show it several times and make sure it's clean in the first place. You think it's in the language. You think that language would be loose enough to allow that.
Representative Simon.
I don't want to misrepresent. No, I think if it was already in the lease that certain fees were due and owing, then that wouldn't change. But I don't want to mischaracterize. This language, as I read it, and if anyone else wants to chime in, they may, but there is no extra fee that can be imposed. This language does not provide that. So I want to be clear about that.
So, Representative Western.
Last, Mr. Chair. So at a minimum, under this language, the landlord would have to have a clause that says, for any reason of default or early termination, they reserve the right to charge the cost of renting out the property, et cetera, et cetera. If that was in the lease, that would be collected.
Representative Simon.
Representative Westrom, Mr. Chair, let me turn it over for further clarification to Melinda Hugdahl, who has been instrumental in this process.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hugdahl, again, and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Services Advocacy Project. excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, there isn't anything specifically in the bill about allowing an extra administrative fee. Some of the concern that we heard in discussing that issue was that we didn't want to make it cost prohibitive for victims to terminate a lease. The 1 month's rent for some folks is an obstacle they're going to have to meet, and that amount is payable before the date that their tenancy terminates. So if they terminate, give a notice in February, and it's for March 15th, they owe the March rent and April as it is. So to add an administrative fee onto that, this bill is intended for people who have an imminent safety fear to leave the apartment. So that's kind of the balance that we've been working with the Multi-Housing Association, is trying to balance that, and we certainly are understanding of the situation that the landlord is in. Certainly if there was damage to the apartment, that would be an issue with a security deposit, which does not change under this bill. That would be consistent with what the law is right now.
I think that Mr. Gehring wants to just direct us to a little bit of language in the bill that might help answer some of this question. Mr. Gehring?
Sure. Yeah, I was going to point out in Subdivision 3, Paragraph A, which is lines 2.3 and 2.4, there's language that says that the tenant is relieved of any contractual obligation for payment of rent or any other charges for the remaining term of the lease. And so I think that would effectively it prevent a landlord from charging an additional fee for having to re-rent the premises.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Representative Western, one last
up. Mr. Chair, I assume Mr. Horner is in the room.
He is, Representative Western.
Is that one of the sticking points that's going on here, or the landlord's just happy to rent out a property? I mean, I understand this is a balancing act and a give and take, but sometimes a property that rents for $1,000 or $2,000 might cost close to a month's rent to re-rent it, and that's part of the benefit of having a 12 or 24-month lease. So,
Mr. Horner?
Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. Sorry, if you could state your name for the record.
Thank you. Jack Horner, representing Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Westrum. It is part of the balancing. The
payment of a fee equal to 1 month's rent is something that the landlord can use for the re-rent fees. If he's fortunate enough to re-rent it, he perhaps comes out ahead in the long run. On the other hand, if it's the middle of the winter and your unit stands empty for 3 or 4 months, the landlord might very well end up on the short end. So that is part of the balancing, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Horner. All right. Representative Smith.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Horner, then my reading is that upon termination pursuant to the terms of the bill, that all that is owing to the landlord is 1 month's rent. Any other monies owed under the lease contract are over.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, the tenant would owe the rent for the full current month. Mr. Chairman, also I must say we are in some ways referring to language that we've talked about but isn't directly before you at this point, changes that we expect will be made. The concept is that the tenant would owe and be liable for paying rent for the entire month in which the tenancy takes place, whatever part of the month that is, plus an amount equal to one additional rent, one additional month.
Mr. Chairman, let me rephrase my question then based on what I just heard. My reading of the bill is that upon termination of the lease, pursuant to the terms of the bill, the tenant can move owing the rent for the month, for that month that they are moving, plus one additional month, and all other monies owed under the lease are over. Is that correct?
Mr. Horner.
Mr. Chairman, in order to use this provision at all, before it's effective at all...
Mr. Chairman, was my question correct or not?
Representative Smith, Mr. Horner.
Yes or no, sir, and then explain.
Partially no. And the explanation is, Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, that in order to use this provision at all, the tenant would have to pay prior to the vacating date, to the termination date, this one additional month's rent. So the tenant has to pay at least that amount or this provision is null and void. The tenant may leave owing back rent, which he would remain liable for. He may owe rent for that current month, which he may or may not have paid already. If he hasn't, he'd be liable for it. But he must pay that month's rent, that additional month's rent, in advance, or this provision is of no effect. And finally, as been alluded to before, if the tenant owes any further amount, say for physical damage or other amounts due, that could be taken from the damage deposit as under current law.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith. Mr. Horner, then upon termination, in the hypothetical that I heard you summarize, upon termination under this bill of a lease with rent owing, still owing, in that case, is it your anticipation and is it your understanding that that rent would still be owing? And I see you nodding, so the answer is yes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes.
And the second part of the question is, if there is a security deposit or a last month's rent, if you will, paid at the beginning of the tenancy, if there is a security deposit, that if the terms of the lease on the security deposit are that should a person leave owing rent or prior to the termination under the lease, the security deposit is forfeited to the landlord, yet the terms of the bill say any other charges are terminated. Where does that security deposit go in that hypothetical? Does the tenant get it or does the landlord keep it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative said that the tenant leaves owing rent, the damage deposit may be used to cover that, which is again current law.
Again, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and of the author, even though I'm reading in your bill that the under subdivision 3 that the tenant terminating is re- relieved of any contractual obligation or any other charges for the remaining term of the lease. Is that your understanding, that that security deposit representative would be forfeited to the landlord?
Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, I should probably defer to Ms. Hugdell on that one, only because, I'll be honest, she's been more directly involved in the negotiations with Mr. Horner than I have personally.
Ms. Hugdell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, under the bill, the sums owing that are discharged are things that are prospective charges. So if there are things like back rent owing, if there's damage to the apartment, those things could be brought by the landlord as an action against the tenant. And those would be under existing law about security deposits and actions for unpaid rent. So that's kind of how the bill fits together. So if there's a security deposit there and there's an let's say there's unpaid rent from before, that would operate under the law as it is. What this bill is getting at is the prospective months of rent or other charges that would happen upon, for example, early termination. But if there's unpaid rent, other things that could now be leveraged against the security deposit, those would remain.
Representative Smith,
Mr. Chairman,
one or two more.
I apologize. One more question. I might be looking for trouble here, so I probably should not ask this question. But I'm going to ask
dangerous preamble, Representative Smith.
I'm a co-author, and I did read the bill, Representative Pamar. Now I'm trying to understand what I read. This bill passes, and we have an astute landlord who right now has a lease that says if you can terminate your lease. Mm-hmm. I hate these hypotheticals, but I'm going to try to paint them. You can terminate your lease halfway through it, but then you owe me 2 months or 200% of 1 month or whatever. In other words, you pay to get out of your lease up front. And what if the landlord revises his lease and says, notwithstanding anything contained in MS 504B.206 sub whatever laws of the session, you still owe the following. Is it your intent that this bill negate those kinds of post-legislative rewrites of leases or not?
Ms. Hundahl.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, yes. Subdivision 5 has a waiver that's prohibited, so the landlord cannot put in an application or a lease agreement that it requiring a tenant to waive that. The landlord, the tenant, after the notice is there, dates they want to modify or talk about, they can do that by mutual agreement, but the landlord can't require a waiver of the provision of the statute.
So, Mr. Chair, so that's the answer you really did want to hear. We're going to prevent some jackbird landlord down the road from trying to undo what we're trying to do here. Is that correct?
Ms. Hundahl.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, my answer would be yes. That's certainly our intent.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Smith, for your thorough questions. Representative Holberg, I believe, has a question.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and I'm a little afraid to admit that I think Representative Smith and I are kind of on the same wavelength here.
Why?
No offense.
It is 7:10 for those of you know, but this is Representative Holberg.
Why then, if you are intending that if the tenant would be liable for any damages or associated with the security deposit, why did you not call out the security deposit and its conditions on lines 2.5 and 2.6 for the exception?
Ms. Hardell?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the reference in 2.11 to 504B.178 is the security deposit statute. And so we're talking about, this talks about the unpaid rent and the sums, and then we went on specifically to talk about the security deposit in there. And that's the, that was talking about the date of the security deposit and how it operates, but certainly this was talking about the unpaid rent of the other sums. So there is that specific reference to the security deposit.
Representative Holman.
And Mr. Chair, that was where I was going to go next, because the way I read lines 14, 15, and 16, It talks about the landlord is entitled to compensation under the subdivision only if the landlord has actually incurred damages. So in other words, if somebody in February has a restraining order, meets the conditions, or order for protection, meets the conditions, and says, I'm going to vacate the 15th of March, and here's March rent for the extra month, mm-hmm. and then the landlord gets busy and somebody moves in, say, the 20th of March, and he receives rent for the 10 days, then does he, in fact, owe money back to the tenant? And if not, then why not? Because this says that the landlord only gets the money if they've actually can prove damage.
Ms. Hudgall?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I'm trying to think through here. I think with the security deposit piece, the damages, if the person gives the notice, their tenancy continues until the date they actually vacate, which is put in the notice. So any damages that occur up until that date would be covered as a possibility against the leverage against the security deposit they have. So if they tell the landlord in February they're moving out, but the vacate date is in March 15th, anything that happens during that time would be covered under the security deposit. I'm not sure.
This is helping me because now I know why we're thinking different here. You're reading the term documented damages to the property itself. When I read this, I used the term damages in that the landlord suffered some loss of income as a result of the termination. So I don't think that this is clear in delineating those differences relative to just property damage versus was I or not out a full month's rent, irregardless of when the person terminated.
Mr. Horner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, this is a provision that we are in process of changing, I think reflecting the confusion or the unclearness that does need to be cleaned up. My understanding, and I'll state it publicly, I believe we are in agreement, is that in order to exercise this provision, the tenant would pay a fee or equal to 1 month's rent, and the landlord keeps that in any case. That is, and it is kind of a gamble. The landlord might be out several months' rent, conceivably, or he might not. He might be lucky and rent it again the next month. But as was alluded to earlier, the landlord would have expenses in any case, and so that's kind of the compromise. The tenant would pay the fee in advance. And in addition to any rent that's owed through the tenancy, and the landlord would not have to return that. In addition, there may be physical damages, which could be covered under the damage deposit.
I'm assuming this is getting laid over.
That is correct.
And is it true that you'll have more concise language by whenever we're putting this bill together, which I'm not sure when, but I don't want to spend any more committee time on it, but I think it needs a little massaging.
I appreciate that, Representative Holbert. I believe that we're talking about putting the bill together for distribution and comment on Thursday and then passage on Friday, or markup on Friday, I should say. Don't want to be too presumptive. Representative Westrum, briefly.
Mr. Chair, briefly, this led to a couple more questions, but I'll try to limit it to one. Mr. Horner, if I understand, what you're in discussions about is it would be like a fee, a get out of your lease early fee of 1 month's rent. Does that mean they move out on the day they give notice, or they stay in that apartment during that whole month because you can't rent it out early or to somebody else until that person's moved out?
Mr. Horner, Westrum. It's the latter situation, and that was an important part of this bill, is that the tenant in exercising the rights under this provision would have to state a definite date on which the tenancy terminates so that the landlord would know whether he has a vacant unit or not and exactly when for purposes of re-renting it and showing it. So there would be a specific date upon which the tenancy terminates. The tenant, of course, would have to be out by that date. And unless he's holding over, or perhaps even with the permission of the landlord, but the tenancy would end, and the tenant would have paid it the date, the fee by that time.
So, Representative West, Mr. Chair, that's what I'm getting confused. When you say the fee, are you referring to the last month's rent, of which the renter has used every day?
Mr.
Horner.
Mr. Chairman, and I apologize for that. In language we've talked about, we use the term fee. I am, in fact, talking about the payment of the next month's rent, which is equivalent to what you would say to Representative Restrom, sort of like a break lease fee or a re-rent fee that would... but that is what we're talking about. It's a payment of an amount equal to the month's rent after the termination of the tenancy.
So, Mr. Horner, I think so that we're all on the same ground here. If written notice is given January 15th and vacated soon after, then then all of February's rent will also be needed to be paid. Is that correct? So therefore you've paid all of January and then you need to pay the next following month's rent. Is that correct, Mr. Horner?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. If the move-out date stated in the notice is January 15, then January's rent in full is owed, and the tenant would then have to pay an amount equal to February's rent in order to exercise the rights under this provision.
And Mr. Horner, the same would be true if it were January 2nd of the move-out date.
Yes.
Great. Thank you. Representative Western, anything else?
Would that also be true if it's January 31st?
Mr. Horner, the answer is yes.
Yes.
And if they moved out February 2nd, Mr. Chair, I know we want to move on here. If they moved out February 2nd, then it would just push out and they would... So if I'm understanding you correctly, the tenant is actually moving out 30 days before their pay... sooner than what they're paying for. If in that the landlord has actually got 1 month of the apartment being vacant, that they could rent it out, and if they rent it out sooner than that month, they actually gain a little... more rent for that month than normal. If they don't, they're out that amount plus whatever rent they don't get. Is that right, Mr. Horner?
Mr. Chairman, the representative
Mr. Horner
is correct.
Okay. Mr. Western, I believe that's the sort of fine balance that really represents the compromise, that there could be a real benefit.
Mr. Chair, and that's what I was not understanding, because I was understanding they're paying the last month's rent, which meant that they're also in the apartment until that last day of January 31st or February 28th. And if that's the last day they've paid any amount of money for, the landlord can't put anybody in sooner than March 1st. And so I think I got it.
Thank you, Representative Westrom. Any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, House File 1841 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. And thank you very much, Mr. Horner, Ms. Hugdahl, and Representative Simon.
Mr. Chairman,
thank you.
Next up is Representative Paymar with House File 1354. And we are on a similar procedure again, where the subcommittee report has been adopted. And we now do have the bill... physically in front of us, formally in front of us. And Representative Paymar, it looks like you have an amendment for us, is that correct?
I do. Mr. Chair,
Representative Paymar.
Am I deciding to move the bill, or?
I believe that we are laying the bill over for possible inclusion, but it would be nice if you did move the bill so we can formally discuss it.
House File 1354, it was heard in the subcommittee. I do have an amendment that I'm sort of reluctantly offering, but I understand some of the concerns by law enforcement. And I would like to move the A1 amendment. And what that does, I'll move the amendment, but I'll explain what it does.
Thank you, Representative Paymar. Representative Paymar moves the A1 amendment
and I believe that all members have it in front of them. So, Representative Paymar, to your amendment.
Mr. Chair, the reason why we're taking this out is law enforcement does have concerns about us prohibiting the shall ask. They're fine with leaving in the words require. But what we've inserted, and I believe Mr. Gillespie can speak to this, he's fine with the amendment that if the law enforcement agency asks a complainant to submit to a polygraph, that they that the complainant has the opportunity to consult with a sexual assault counselor. And so the reason for this bill, members, if you weren't at part of a subcommittee, is twofold. That requiring a victim to submit to a polygraph essentially is re-victimizing her. I would submit also that I'm not sure why law enforcement needs to ask, but they think that this is a tool that they'd like to hang on to. Secondly, the other reason that we're asking for approval of this bill is that in 2005, when there was the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, there's a federal provision that says that you are not a state or a jurisdiction eligible for its stop monies unless they have this provision in law. And stop monies are used to train police officers and prosecutors in the state of Minnesota. We get about $2 million a year, I believe. So that's the bill, that's the amendment. Karen Long is here from the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. If you have any questions about the bill, let me know.
Thank you, Representative Paymar. I would actually like to, just for the record, call Mr. Gillespie, up just to state just very, very briefly, just essentially, I understand that Representative Paymar's amendment is one that you've asked for, and if you could just really state quickly that you support the amendment. Is that correct, Mr. Gillespie? If you could state your name for the record first, sorry.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Gillespie, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. We think this is a wonderful amendment, artfully crafted and fully invested in the needs and concerns of law enforcement.
Thank you, Mr. Gillespie. plenty eloquent. Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Paymar on his A1 amendment? To the amendment, Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Paymar. I'm glad that they can still ask. But I'm curious about how the new Subdivision 2 is worded, and I have a couple questions. Why would the request for a polygraph have to occur prior to proceeding with investigation, charging, or prosecuting? I would assume that the police would do some investigating before they would decide whether or not there was a need to ask for a polygraph. And can the polygraph occur after they begin investigating or charging, or is it only allowed prior to?
Representative Holbert and Representative Paymar, I believe that Representative Holbert is talking about line 1.6 of the A1 amendment.
You give permission to law enforcement to ask that a complainant submit to a polygraph prior to proceeding, blah, 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 blah. So I don't know why you need that prior to. Why is that even in there? As a part of or in conjunction with an investigation, da, 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 but I don't understand the timing of that. And then on line 7, the language related to the sexual assault counselor, some victims or alleged victims may not want to consult with a counselor. So I'm wondering if they have to consult in order for the polygraph to go forward, or just be given the opportunity to consult with a sexual abuse counselor. Is it really taking away the ability to decide whether or not a victim or alleged victim wants to have a consultation you might have a victim that wants to take the polygraph, wants to prove that their story is true, that they can pass the polygraph, and have no interest at all in consulting with a counselor.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Paymar.
Representative Holberg, I think that's totally fine. Not all victims of domestic or sexual abuse that speak to an advocate. So what if we just amended line 7 to say that a complainant has been given an opportunity to consult with a sexual assault counselor? Then, Mr. Chair, I would move that to strike referred to and consulted and insert given an opportunity to consult. What was the other thing?
And then you modify the ability to ask by saying submit to a polygraph examination prior to proceeding with investigation, charging, or prosecution. I would think that request for a polygraph should be able to occur before, after, during, any time.
Representative Holberg, Mr. Zeebo, I think, has something to say about the subject. Mr. Zeebo.
Mr. Chair and members, and Representative Holberg, my interpretation of this is as an investigation, charging, or prosecution of such an offense, and so it, at any point in that stage, it doesn't need to be prior to the whole thing starting. It can be prior to modifies investigation, charging, or prosecution, any of those steps. It doesn't say and prosecution, so it doesn't require you to take the step before any of those things start.
Representative Holder.
Mr. Chair, can you still ask them to submit to a polygraph test after the investigation has started and you're into charging and prosecuting? Do you lose the right because all of that's already started and you haven't asked yet?
Mr. Deeble.
Mr. Chair and members, I would presume that you wouldn't get to the prosecution stage and need to, after prosecution begins or completes, I just don't think you could ask for a polygraph, but that would be part of the investigation. If they had doubts about the claim, they should have raised them prior to proceeding with charges in the first place.
Mr. Deeble, the way that it's worded currently with the three elements, their investigation, charging, or prosecution, would, if the investigation and charging phases have been completed, because of the or qualifier, would they still be able to ask a complainant to submit to a polygraph as worded? If the investigation and charging, I think this goes to the question, does it not?
To try and move this along, again, it's getting laid over, so think about it and bring it back. But why wouldn't you just say, a law enforcement agency or prosecutor may ask that a complainant of a criminal sexual offense, submit to a polygraph, and then drop all the way down to line 7, provided that the complainant has been referred to a sexual assault counselor as assigned, blah, 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 blah.
Representative Paymar?
Well, I think it takes out it takes out three levels here, the investigation stage, the charging stage, and the prosecution stage of doing it.
But that means they can do it any time in the whole process. At any time, law enforcement could say, you know, would you be willing to take a polygraph? You don't have to, it's coming back, and I'm not going to waste any more time, but I just don't know why you would modify.
Let's see, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Holder, we'll look at the language. There is some specific language that BAWA requires, and so I just want to make sure we're not doing anything to jeopardize the funding. So we'll look at the language and respond to it.
Thank you, Representative Paymar. And as long as Representative Cornish, I believe, is passing, we still are on the A1 amendment. We have not yet adopted it, so I believe that Representative Paymar will renew his motion to adopt the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please. As amended, thank you. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. To House File 1354, any further testimony, any further questions for Representative Paymar or Ms. Long? Thank you very much. We will lay over House File 1354 for possible inclusion.
And we are now awaiting the ceremonial arrival of our presiding chair.
Are we hearing Abel's bill from you?
Members, Chair Mullery is delayed, one might say detained, in the Commerce Committee. If you could hold on 1 minute. After consultation with staff, we are going to recess for 15 minutes until 7:45, we will reconvene at that time, and hopefully Chair Mullery will be out of committee. And we appreciate your patience as we're juggling the multiple obligations.
And Mr. Chair, is Representative Abel still been pulled, or I wasn't sure at the beginning, do we need to find him, or?
Representative Holbrook, I believe that the House file 1041 has indeed been pulled for today, and Mr. Baldwin can explain that to you personally. Thank you very much. We are in recess. We are reconvened, and welcome again to your committee, Chair Mullery. I believe that House file 2265 is the business before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see you know how to take charge of your staff. I wish I had that much control over my staff.
No comment, Chair Mullery. I believe that you will be moving to consider House File 2065 for possible inclusion.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Excellent.
Proceed. Mr. Chairman, this bill deals with people who are still on supervised release or parole. They were convicted of violent crimes as set forth in the statutes for violent crimes and drug offenses. And they have not done their time. They could still be in prison, but they received release into the community with an agreement that they will submit to various conditions, including searches. They are allowed to help them get back into the community and into a regular crime-free life, and they are to stay away from things that would get them into the criminal lifestyle again. They most definitely do not have all their rights restored. So under Minnesota law now, a probation officer cannot only stop and search a probationer assigned to them, but they also can appear unscheduled at their residence and search the home. This bill doesn't do anything to the search of the home. However, it does recognize the reality that metro counties are large and have a lot of people, especially with our cutback in funds. Most probation officers rarely have time to leave their offices and drive around to see if any of their probationers are doing something that doesn't look like it helps their rehabilitation. This bill deals with the reality that exists. It allows other probation officers or law enforcement to do the kind of checks of probationers that their own probation officer could do if he or she had the time. The guy is on probation for the crime of shooting someone in a drug deal, and he's part of a gang, and the probationer is seen hanging around with known gang members who regularly sell drugs on the corner where the probationer is at. There's a good chance that the probationer is not doing everything possible to rehabilitate himself and stay away from anything that might lead him back into crime. According to Emily Shapiro, this bill dates back and when she was our House research expert on criminal law for many years. And she said that many courts have ruled that when a probationer's conditions of probation so authorize, searches may be conducted without a reasonable cause basis. She also indicated there is case law in other jurisdictions for statutorily authorizing probation officers to stop known probationers in public areas. This is not like a Terry stop and frisk. That applies to anyone, not just people on probation. The Terry situation only applies where a law enforcement officer has a reasonable suspicion criminal activity is occurring. While it doesn't require probable cause, it does require actions indicating a probability of criminal activity. Also, the police officer can only pat the outside of the clothing to see if there's something that feels like a weapon. If they feel it's something that's probably contraband, they can't even look at it. The Terry stop only allows the police officer to protect himself or herself from being assaulted while they're asking questions. The Terry stop has absolutely nothing to do with probation, rehabilitation, or protection of public safety.
This is also different if you're a legal expert from a Griffin situation. In Griffin, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld search of a probationer's home where the probation officer was acting pursuant to an authorizing statute. In turn, Minnesota enacted a statute allowing the probationer's probation officer to stop and search the probationer, including searching their home. With regard to my bill, Ms. Shapiro stated, if under your proposal, probation and peace officers stop only known probationers and require them to identify themselves, such a stop can likely be justified under Griffin and his progeny. She also indicated the U.S. Supreme Court and most state appellate courts agree that sentencing courts may place special conditions of probation on probationers. These special conditions may require the probationer's consent to submit to searches of their person or property on the demand of a probation officer. And it was either, Representative Smith may remember, but it was included in your draft of your crime omnibus bill, one of the last, that would have been 2 years ago, I believe. And then I found out, no, it was last year, I believe. And then I found out later, you may remember, why a certain member that didn't like it cut a deal with another member who got it killed in your committee. But I found out last summer what exactly happened. But so, Representative Smith, I don't know if you remember, but you had included it in your omnibus. So, you're welcome. Mr. Chair, this...
Mr. Chairman.
I'm not sure if you really wanted to jump in on this one, but...
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to comment, but if I were to comment...
I think we heard a similar preamble about an hour ago.
A great number of things were in our omnibus bill at various stages of the legislative session. That is correct.
Chair Muller,
yes, I'm sure he probably remembers the deal that was cut. It wasn't involving him. Mr. Chair, I have John Zandmiller, who's a probation officer in the north side of Minneapolis, which is, as you know, the toughest place in the state. And in fact, his office is on 26th Avenue North, which is the heart of the drug trade. And so he sees these people every day. So he'd like to testify.
Thank you, Chair Mulry. I believe the second toughest place in the state may be in your committee. But welcome to the committee and to combat zone number two. But welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you. My name is John Zandmiller, and I am a probation officer, and I have the unique honor of being the probation officer for North Minneapolis and Representative Mullery's district. It creates quite a challenge. I was assigned to that area shortly after the riots that were coming up on the five-year anniversary, and the work that we're doing there is making a difference. My first night on duty up there, guys would come up to my window when I'd be stopped at 26th and Knox, knock on my window and ask me if I wanted to buy reefer or crack. Last summer I watched kids riding their tricycles on that same sidewalk. We are making a change. But nonetheless, we do see circumstances and incidents that warrant a reasonable check on offenders that are known to us. In some cases, I've been out with the Minneapolis Police Department, which is what we typically do. We work with the Minneapolis Police Department. Came up on someone that was known to me to be on probation, and I asked him, along with the officer, to come over to the car and empty his pockets and place them on the hood of the car. Well, when he emptied out his pockets, there was all the pot that he had stuffed in them in individual little ring baggies. They're these wonderful little Ziploc bags that are about the size of your thumbnail. Two of those sell for $15 in the north side of Minneapolis. It's happening. And we see conditions that say things like no weapons, no possession of narcotics. How are we to enforce them if we don't have a mechanism in place that allows us to do just that? I'm not looking for the opportunity to just go out and be a cowboy. Believe me, I have three beautiful daughters at home, and my primary mission every day I go to work is to go home and be with those three beautiful kids. But we need to have this here. Recently, one of my colleagues, along with police, went to the home of an offender and conducted a search and found a firearm. the decision is made to take that case to the federal level. Unfortunately, the federal level says, where's your state law that supports your ability to search and threw the weapon case out? We need to have solid support. Speaking as a professional in this industry who wants to provide a quality service and create safer neighborhoods, need to have this grounded firmly. We've talked over and over again in the past about the situation with probation officer authority. It's a hodgepodge. It's a patchwork quilt of laws governing whether you're in a DOC county or a court services county or a Community Corrections Act county. This is something that's going to allow us to know where to act, what our boundaries are, what our responsibilities are, so that we can better provide that service to the community we serve. There's been a fundamental change in how we do our business. If you ask departments across the state what their mission was, it was to rehabilitate the offender. Now it's to promote public safety, to restore victims and communities, and then to rehabilitate the offender. We recognize that. We realize that the people of the city of Minneapolis or any other community, whether it be Minneapolis, Duluth, or Granger, all deserve to have quality services delivered. And that's why I think that this bill is important. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zandmiller. Any questions from any Representative Holberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mulray, I had a chance to talk to you a little bit about this. I'm concerned about the any motor vehicle issue, and that, I mean, you might not even know that the person you have is on probation, and you might be a do-gooder bringing them to church or whatever, you know. I mean, I'm uncomfortable with that, in that somebody completely law-abiding, innocent, and not that you'd find anything or whatever, it just seems pretty invasive.
Well, and Mr.
Chair Mulray
and Representative Holberg, I know there's a lot of do-gooders with Uzis under their seat that are driving around picking these people up and going to church a lot, but I that's not my issue here as much. And so after you talked to me, I had thought I would not oppose an amendment that, like on line 113, that took out "in," the word "in" at the end, and put in "driven by," and took out "which," left in the "inmates," and then take out "is found."
And Mr. Chair, maybe you could even also go as far as it's registered to. I mean, if it's the bad actor's car, that they own it, it's their property.
Is driven by or what?
Chair Mulray.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg. Yeah, that would be okay too, driven by or registered in the name of.
And Mr. Chairman, this is getting laid over as well, so it's time to work on it. And then I listened to the testimony, and are you saying there's other areas of law in which you already have the right to search their premises without permission?
Chair Mulray.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Wojcicki always is called Mr. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, yes, the probation officer themselves, I believe, can do it, as Ms. Shapiro explained it to me. But, like, let's say John is not assigned to, well, Dennis is a known, you know, violent felon, and so Dennis is standing on, actually, Mr. Zandmiller and the police have done they're working on 26, and they've driven him up to where I live now, so let's say Dennis is standing on Lowry, and my understanding from Ms. Shapiro was, and maybe Jeff or Becky's not here, but would know, but that they can do their own, but they can't, let's say, I mean, John knows and the police know, like, the 20 or 10 worst, and that hang around the north side, and they can't do for somebody else. Somebody else's probation, NER, I guess is the name. I guess it's called, anyhow, the person is on probation. Like, if Dennis is on probation, that's my understanding. And this would allow
Let's say if Representative Cornish is the cop up there, or Mr. Van Miller, and they know that Dennis is still on paper for a violent drug offense. It has to be within the statute on violent offenses. And then they could do that under this.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Holberg.
Chair Walbury, I understand that part of it, but in your introductory remarks, you talked about court cases, et cetera, and being able to search their residence, their place that they live, and I'm just wondering if there's another place in current law that that's addressed. Because it sounded like you wanted that authority somewhere, and I'm just saying a search of the...
Chair Miller, proceed.
Representative Holbert, no, we're not asking for authority to go into the home. This doesn't say that.
Representative
Holbert.
And Mr. Chair and Chair Mulley, currently do they have the right to do that?
Chair Mulley.
Mr. Chairman, maybe Mr. Zanmiller does. I think Ms. Shapiro thought that under the law they did. I don't know if Mr. Zanmiller, what do you think?
Representative Holberg, or should we look to staff?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to this, but I maybe I misunderstood Chairman Mulley's testimony. I thought you also wanted the authority to be able to search their premises, or that be a condition of release, that you have that authority, and I only see the person and the car in this bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, no, I think I said that I believe there's, that at least the interpretation Ms. Shapiro had was that they can't, just the person who was assigned, the probation officer like assigned to Dennis, could go to the house, but if Mr. Zanmiller, if I'm the probation officer for Dennis, my understanding is Mr. Zanmiller can't go and require him to go in.
Mr. Zanmiller, do you have anything to add about maybe what your current practice is? And
well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holzberg, members of the committee. This is a very cloudy area, and it really needs clarification. I think Representative Mulley's bill goes a long way to doing this. Yes, we do have this, but there's nothing in terms of case law that really supports it. There's implied and expressed conditions of probation. Generally, it's been the accepted practice throughout the state that the probationer has wide authority to conduct searches to ensure compliance, provided that the search fits with the conditions. For instance, if there's a condition that the defendant shall have no possession of illegal narcotics or firearms, it's reasonable to conduct a search with reasonable suspicion for the presence of firearms and narcotics. However, a couple of years ago, the Bear decision came down and said, unless it is specifically ordered, said he has to submit to search. You can't do that because it becomes an unlawful extension of court power to give it to probation officer. What we seek to do here is to correct that issue by making it a standardized issue. Homes are still allowable because that's, and when I go into an offender's home, I do a cursory search to ensure that there's nothing immediately visible that poses a threat to myself or to anybody else that may be with me, usually a police officer. And then I say, I need to see your room. But the problem is once we move beyond that area where there's their domicile, where they report to me, where they live, we get into a gray area where there's nothing to support us other than standard practices and some rules that are tied in with existing statutes. Part of the confusion is that some statutes were called peace officers and others were not. So we have to rely on those statutes to determine what are legitimate authorities.
Chairman,
Mr. Chairman, I want to clarify something for Representative Holbrook. He was talking about he himself being the probation officer, for instance, for Dennis. If I'm another probation officer in his office, or a lot of the probation officers, for instance, are down on, what's that address, on the south side where a lot of the
there's only four on the north side, and yet a lot of their, you might call them clients, are in my district up there selling drugs. This authority that he's talking about wouldn't go to anybody like me who was another probation officer. Let's say he's on the south side, and yet because we have so many people on probation up there, and in fact one out of every nine men in one of my neighborhoods is on probation still. So they have probation officers elsewhere. But Mr. Zandmiller may know, or the cops that work that area know, that let's say Dennis is on probation. So this would let them see, for instance, if Dennis had a gun or something like that.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Zandmiller.
I'm sorry, if I might add some further clarification to this. There's several, hundreds, 300 agents in my department. And frequently we'll work on a team. An agent from the south side may come up to the north side and work the district. This allows that authority to be extended to them. If I'm requested to check on a client who belongs to our domestic abuse unit on the south side, I see him coming out of Jug Liquor at Broadway and Washington. I can stop him with the assistance of a police officer and say, we need to have that. So it does. It grants us more of the authority as agents versus that one agent to another agent. We do get things like the top 50 list for the most dangerous offenders. And this provides us with a tool to more adequately supervise and intervene. The idea is, just like so many other things, if you talk to old parole agents and they'll tell you the same thing. If you're cracking down on guys for the small stuff, the big stuff doesn't happen.
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to restate my question. We can talk later. Do you have the authority, if you're not the assigned probation officer, to enter the premises or home of somebody not assigned to you? And if not, do you need legislation to give you that authority? I see person here, but I don't see residence or place of work or...
Representative Cornish, to this point.
Well, at this point, I think if we just stick to the bill, why ask all the questions about the residents? Because this looks like the offender in the car, and otherwise I think we're going to talk about possible scenarios all night. But this doesn't look like it affects the residents.
Mr. Chair, I guess they don't want to go into the residents, I guess is what I'm surmising.
They do.
Representative Cornish.
I mean, if they want, they could bring it up in another bill, but this one doesn't look like it has anything to do with residences.
Mr. Muller.
Representative Cornish is correct. It does not get at that.
Representative Bingham, I believe, has been patiently waiting for a question. To ask it, sorry, not to receive it.
Mr. Zandmiller, thank you for your... Mr. Paymar. Kind of in my line of
fire. Representative Bingham, the line of fire is the next bill.
Oh, Mr. Chair and Mr. Zandmiller, thank you for your testimony. Just a couple questions, and I know the answers, but do you carry a gun?
Mr. Zandmiller.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bingham, under a separate state law, the only municipal, county, or state employee that is required allowed to carry a firearm in the discharge of their duties is a licensed peace officer.
Okay.
Representative Bingham.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Zandmiller, would there ever be a time, if this does pass, that you would ever be approaching, Chair Mullery said, a first-degree drug offender with a gun who is hanging around with a known gang member on a corner? Would you ever approach him by yourself?
Representative Sam Miller.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bingham? Oh, absolutely not. One of the things that I pride myself on is knowing the lethality of the offenders that I work with, as well as the major players in a neighborhood. believe me, if I came up on a situation like that, there'd be no way that I would approach them. I had a gentleman on my caseload who is entering a plea in the next few weeks on a homicide charge, a fairly well-known homicide charge. Prior to him being named as a suspect in the homicide charge, when I'd go and do home visits on him, I routinely brought at least two police officers with me to the home because the locality was there. It's one of the things that I was trained, and I train others. Don't go out and be a hero. It makes absolutely no sense.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bingham.
Mr. Handler, would... I mean, and I know it's hard for you to speak to other probation officers, but I guess what I'm getting at, is there going to be a scenario where a probation officer would be going into a potentially dangerous, or even just checking up on somebody that they know is maybe walking out of a liquor store, not knowing that maybe they have a gun or have another weapon with them, or maybe the people that they're associating with, known gang members, have weapons on them. Are there probation officers, or is it possible a scenario would come up where they would approach by themselves under that situation?
Mr. Zamiller.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bingham, you're right, I can't speak for everyone. Is it conceivable that someone in the course of a casual walk from Johnny A's 200 Club comes across somebody coming out of jug liquor that's on their caseload or another caseload with, you know, something rectangular in a brown paper bag, saying, what's in the bag, open the bag, and having them pull out something with a little more lethality? Certainly. But the way I train my colleagues is to stop and think before you do anything. Think about the situation. When I first came into this business, one of the things that was taught to me is you will get an additional opportunity to rehabilitate someone who is reluctant to be rehabilitated at the time you're dealing with them. I instill that in the people that I train. Now, I think that an area that does warrant some concern is training universal? Is it across the state? Could it be better? Certainly. But that is more of a training issue than a legislative issue.
Well, Representative Bingham.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Zan Miller and Chair Mullery, I mean, I've spoken to both of you about my concerns over this bill. My biggest concern is that a probation officer, maybe not even thinking that this is a dangerous situation, all of a sudden puts themselves in a dangerous situation because they have the right to do this. And I know that obviously Representative Holbrook may have some concerns about the bill too, so I'm hoping that before this is being laid over, that hopefully before that, the four of us can maybe get together or at least discuss some of the concerns in it, because I think you get to a broader point, which is that the training is probably not universal, and I may be scrupulous to say it is not universal, and that now we're giving people the legislation that we have here is giving people the ability to do that. And I'm not just talking about North Minneapolis, but there are obviously other areas of the state that this could occur in. And it's something that a situation where a parole officer doesn't think it's a dangerous situation, all of a sudden becomes one. And so I just have a big fear about doing this. I have had many conversations before you even introduced this bill about these, and it still wasn't really fixed. So,
Mr. Zamiller,
we can work on it.
Mr. Zamiller, just briefly, Mr. Zamiller, before you answer the question, just want to point out that there are three of us who still have some questions, and we also want to move on to the next bill as well. But and the bill is being laid over, so we'll have more time. But Mr. Zamiller,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to add too. This is, you know, I'm here speaking on behalf of myself as a professional in this field. I'm also married to a probation officer that works in another county. She works in a juvenile institution, and she's been assaulted on the job 2 times more than I have. She's been assaulted twice. So the risk really can't be predicted accurately. The other thing that I can say with some certainty is I do have a pretty good idea of the way things are done across the state. I've had the opportunity to do home visits in rural McLeod County, all the way down to Red Wing, from North Minneapolis to my best friend as a kid growing up down in Rosemount. And these are themes that are seeing, that are going to emerge and continue to emerge throughout the state. And that's why I think this is the most appropriate venue for this.
Mr. Chair, just to that point, I promise we can move on to whomever. But that's my point exactly, is that why do you want to have the ability to possibly walk into this danger when you have the police officers that could go with you on it? What I'm saying is that you're able to, if this passes, you're able to do this without having a police officer come with you. Now you use them. But, and that's you. I'm saying that somebody up in Thief River Falls may not do that. And, your wife has been assaulted. Maybe if she had police officers with her when she maybe approached people, and maybe she wouldn't have happened. I don't know the scenario. But I'm just saying that that's my concern, and I hope it's addressed before we move on to the marking of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Bigham. My concern about the bill, Chair Mulley, or just it's more of a question, I guess, for you and for Mr. Zandmiller, is looking, just working off of Section 1, we write it from the perspective of the parolee and the inmate on under supervision, but the last sentence of Section 1, the search may be conducted on demand. If you are not the assigned probation officer, is there any danger of searching, believing that someone is an individual that they turn out not actually to be? Are we coming into are we just going too far in terms of giving too much license to perform random searches for those who are actually not parolees nor under supervision?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think so. I think that it's all fine and good for people who don't know what's going on in parts of the state. And I think if you came over and met the good people of North Minneapolis and you said that, you'd get told that these things are needed. And I don't think we're going too far at all. I think that the criminals are going too far in this state, and I feel very strongly about that. And coming out of law school, you probably couldn't have found a more liberal on criminal procedure than me. There was one in my law school class, and I can't think of her name, but she's a good judge.
She's a probation officer.
Yeah, but I grew up and I found reality, which a lot of people I find over here don't know what reality is on the north side and parts of other parts of the state. And that bothers me, that they're looking at things from a totally non-real view of what goes on and what we need on the north side. Might that ever happen? It's possible. First of all, there are so many provisions about police misconduct in Minneapolis that the police are almost afraid to do things. And this is a fact, and we've had, unfortunately, a slowdown to some extent by police on not being as effective. And that's hurt our efforts on crime. And to say that it could happen, everything can happen, but the likelihood is not. That's all I can say. I mean, if we're going to protect every person out there from ever anything, you know, what's the worst? I'm not that worried. You know something? If I'm walking along 26 and a cop stops me and says, I want to check if you have a gun, that doesn't bother me because I'm glad that he's there doing that. And that's what the people want, most of them up there. It's very important.
Thank you, Chair Mulley. Mr. Zandmiller, and we're over here in the Representative Corner.
Mr. Chair, if it gives you any peace of mind, typically I'll just give you a quick rundown how we do something like this.
Please, if you could.
Yeah. We get notification of who the top offenders are with their pictures, with their conditions. We frequently get packets from other agents with their picture, with their conditions. We also have immediate access to their chronological notes. We can identify people from our wireless laptops or within the squads through the Department of Motor Vehicle or the booking photos available at the Hennepin County Jail. I don't make that effort or make that attempt unless I'm sure of who we've got. Believe me, a person walking down the street, minding their own business, has got no... there is absolutely no reason to harass, molest, befuddle the whole nine yards. They deserve that right.
and I intend to protect that.
Thank you, Mr. Van Orden. Chair Mullery.
Because the neighborhood groups have put together, and they keep them updated, lists of, like, the 10 worst. And they continually give those to the police, and the cops on the north side that have been there for a while, they can tell me, like, the 10 or 15 that cause 60% of the problems and things like that.
Thank you, Chair Mullery. That answers my question. I appreciate it very much. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. Like Zan Miller, I've been involved in the probation business for a lot of years. And, you know, supervising this sort of clientele is very complicated and complex. And you know, this may or may not be another possible old tool in the toolbox kind of thing. It certainly isn't any panacea for corrections. I do agree with Representative Holberg that the language needs to be tightened up, for example, on the any motor vehicle sort of thing. I think that's a good idea as it moves through the process. Is it a great bill? Probably not. Could it help corrections somewhat? Perhaps. That's my feeling on it.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. We appreciate your experience and perspective. Representative Simon?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I know we got to move on here, but I'm wondering if someone can give us a little constitutional comfort here, apart from whether it's a good idea or bad. It may very well be an excellent idea and give a lot of flexibility to a lot of people. This just seems like it's probably screaming out for a challenge, I would imagine. Has this been challenged in other states? I'm not saying I don't think it's a good idea. I'm just wondering, as you have, Mr. Chair, in other contexts, whether or not are we in a safe place here,
Mr. Chairman and Representative Simon. As I said, Emily Shapiro was very highly thought of around the state. She gave the CLEs for the Criminal Law Institute. That's every July or August. I can't remember. MCLE has a 3-day one. She told me that she didn't think there was any question that it was constitutional, because you, as long as they're on probation, if they were not on paper anymore, then it would not be constitutional. But as long as you're on paper, you're supposed to be reforming your life. And if you're standing down in a drug zone and things like that, hanging around with the gang members you were in with, you're not doing a very good job of trying to make an effort to do that. And she said it would be, there are cases in other states that she said were almost identical. And I can't remember from
Representative Cornish has a missed time phone call, but he actually now has the microphone because he has something to offer us on this.
Council could probably help us out, but I think the whiskey plates where you can automatically pull somebody over without suspicion to do random checks, I think, been tested constitutionally, and I think this is somewhat similar to that. If we authorize in statute, if somebody's already done something wrong and we empower somebody to do a search at first, I think it would, it seems like we're not breaking new ground here.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
and I think we're
okay.
Probably
Mr. Chairman, it's just like, for instance, geographic locations. You can restrict somebody on probation to very restricted areas. You can't go there, you can't go there, you have to be within this area. Absolutely no problem with that. If they were off paper, you couldn't do that at all. Then they'd be unconstitutional. But you got to distinguish when they're on paper and off paper.
Thank you, Chair Mulvey. Any other questions? I imagine there will be a considerable conversation before we see this in the omnibus bill at the end of the week. So with that, members, seeing no further discussion, House File 2265 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Chair Mullery. To your second and much less controversial bill. House File 93. Dr. Early in the session.
Moves House File 93 and move the DE1 amendment that's dated or timed at 1:30 p.m.
Members, Chair Mullery has moved the DE1 amendment from 1:30 p.m. on March 20th, 2007. So the bill can be in the form that the author wishes. All those in favor of adopting the DE1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, the motion prevails. Chair Mullery, you now have the bill in the form that I believe you would like it.
Yes, Mr. So. Chairman, it's not the way I'd like it, but it's the way it's we've agreed on. And
well said.
Mr. Chairman, this also, this one came to me from the head of the probation union in Minneapolis. And it's their number one issue, they told me this year. They can't get access directly to permit records, so they may be going into a house for somebody and they can't find out if that person has a gun permit. And so this would just give them that direct access. It seems to me like it's something they certainly should have to do their duties. And we have reached an agreement to shift it to from the permit statute into the data practices statute. And Mr. Olson is in agreement with it from whatever the title is, Citizens for something. I'm not sure about it.
Perhaps Mr. Olson might want to join you at the table for a moment and state for the record his briefly, I must say, his thoughts on the amendment, or the bill as we have it, excuse me.
Mr. Chairman,
state your name for the record.
Mallory, my name is Joseph Olson. I'm a law school professor at Hamline University, but I'm here tonight in my role as president of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance. I've worked with Representative Mallory today on the DE1 amendment, and we are not opposing it.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Any questions, discussion from members? Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mallory, or who might know the answer to the question, is this held in a central database? How are you going to access this information? And will there be an audit of access to this database?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative
Chair Mallory.
First of all, it's the same database that the police officers get it from, but what did you...
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure how this database was put together. My recollection is that it was held county by county, but there wasn't one big, huge, statewide... Oh, Mr. Verdon's says that it's held at the BCA. So there is one central... Parole and county probation authorities ask for this information, will they have a case number or a identifying factor, and will that request then be audited or kept track of so that we know who's accessing which files and for what purpose?
Chair Mallory, Mr. Zangmiller?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, I can't say for certain because I've never seen it before, but I can tell you what existing practices are. If I run a Bureau of Criminal Apprehension check on someone, I have to be able to put a case number with it. If I go on to GangNet, not only does the BCA know, or the Ramsey County Sheriff, who's the administrator of it, know, but at any time, any user can bring that up and see who else is looking at it. So there are technologies in place, I'm certain, that could make sure that there was no misuse of this.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, let me turn outside to the BCA folks before we put the data practices bill together to make sure we have the right language to assure that.
I appreciate that, Representative Holbert. Any other questions from members? Last chance, Representative Cornish. That... Chair Mullery, House File 93 as amended will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Data Practices Bill. I believe that it brings us to the end of the evening, so the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.